board clerk. Also, please respect the board members, staff, presenters, and your fellow citizens. Everyone's views should be heard. If a lot of people wish to speak, I may place time limits on presentations. If you have any written materials as part of the agenda item, please hand copies to Kathy Odermatt, and she will distribute them. So that we can have an accurate administrative record, please speak after I call your name and invite you to come to the lectern. Please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. Our first item on the agenda this evening is public forum. Any person may address the Water Board concerning a matter within the Water Board's jurisdiction, which is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the Water Board. Comments will generally be limited to 5 minutes. I don't have any cards for this agenda item, but is there anyone who wishes to speak during the public forum? Seeing no one, oops. Item two is the minutes of the May 16 and 17, 2018 meeting. No, it is not. It's the regular meeting from April 11 and 12.
I move we adopt the minutes from
Second.
The April 12 meeting.
Second.
Board Member Dias.
Oh. Aye.
Dr. Horn?
Aye.
Mr. Jardine?
Yes.
Ms. Cox?
Aye.
Mr. Sandell?
Yes.
And I will be abstaining as I was not at that meeting. Item three is proposed scope of work and development of a salt and nutrient management plan for the Fremont Basin Regional Water Management Group.
Glad I have printouts because I can't see that.
Oh, because of the angle. Yeah. I've often wondered how people are supposed to navigate that.
Well, good evening, Chairman, board members. I'm Jan Zimmerman, a senior engineering geologist in the Victorville office. And together with Brian Dietrich, we're presenting to you the scope of work and development of the Salt Nutrient Management Plan for the Fremont Basin. I'd like to point out that this item does have a late revision, so you have a pink sheet, and it starts on base number 310. So if you recall, back in 2010, staff brought to you our strategy for addressing salt nutrient management plans in the region, and our focus has been on high and medium priority basins first, and to encourage the stakeholders to develop these plans under the IRWM, or Integrated Regional Water Management Program. And the board at that time agreed that that approach was good and requested that during the development of these plans, that the scope of work be presented as an informal workshop to the board, to give the board an opportunity to provide input during the process. Then, when the final plan is prepared, the group would come back and ask the board for approval of that plan. The most recent salt nutrient management plan to go through that two-step process is the Indian Wells Valley salt nutrient management. And that one was accepted by the board in April. So, tonight, item number three
is the first presentation of that two-step process. We're in the development phase of the plan. So before we talk specifically about salt nutrient management planning for the Fremont Basin, I wanted to touch on a few key items. First is the Integrated Regional Water Management Program. how the Lahontan funding area fits into that program in the Fremont Basin region, some of the associated planning documents that need to be prepared, and then we'll talk about the timeline and the next steps for the development of the Fremont. So the Integrated Regional Water Management, or IRWM, program was passed by the legislature in 2002. The program is managed by the Department of Water Resources and provides a collaborative process for water resource management on a regional scale. The IRWM program sets up a robust stakeholder-driven process and effort to develop mutually beneficial solutions to water-related problems. One of the primary benefits of the IRWM program is the availability of grant funding. Since 2002, various bond acts approved by the California voters have provided over $1.5 billion in funding to support and advance integrated regional multi-benefit projects. So the IRWM program divides the state into funding areas. There are 12 funding areas. Lahontan, shown in green. It looks green to me. Number 10. Each funding area is assigned its own funding allocation. The funding areas themselves are further divided into regions. Currently, there are 6 regions in the Lahontan funding area. We have Mojave, Antelope Valley, Fremont Basin, Indio Mono, Tahoe Sierra, and Lahontan Basins. To be eligible for funding, a region must first be approved through the regional acceptance process by the Department of Water Resources, be governed by a regional water management group with statutory authority over water management, and prepare an integrated regional water management plan. As the program has evolved, funding is more competitive and requirements are increasing. So for certain types of funding, the regions must also have a groundwater management plan, a stormwater management plan, and a salt nutrient management plan. Let me just point back. I don't think this pointer works. Okay, let's just keep going. In 2011, the Fremont Group completed the region acceptance process, the first step, and officially became recognized as an IRWM region. Following the region acceptance, the Regional Water Management Group formed a memorandum of understanding and officially became a regional water management group in November of 2014. Member agencies of the Fremont Basin Group are California City, Mojave Public Utilities District, and Antelope Valley East Kern Water Agency. California City is taking the lead role for the group. Water Board staff has been involved sort of off and on with the group since before 2011, but it hasn't been since December 2017 that we've really had it hands-on with the group. And in February 2017, the group was awarded $840,000 in a planning grant, which is funding several planning documents. So, like I said, to qualify for some of the IRWM funding, several planning documents need to be prepared. The first one is the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. The second is a Groundwater Management Plan, which is different from a Groundwater Sustainability Plan under SGMA. It's not as robust, and low priority or very low priority basins can prepare the groundwater management. Fremont Basin is a low-priority basin. And a salt nutrient management plan. like to point out that the $840,000 is funding the development of all three of these plans simultaneously. So they're all in stage of development right now. So now let's switch to just the salt and nutrient management plan. And this is the timeline that the group, I think, subject to change, has aggressively presented. So today we're presenting the scope of work, the development phase of the plan in May. We hope to receive a draft of the plan sometime in late June or early August, and staff will review that, and the group will hold a stakeholder meeting for public input. Once all of the public comments and staff comments are incorporated, then the final plan will be prepared sometime possibly in August or late summer. And if all is well, we're hoping to bring the final plan to the board probably in November. That's best case scenario. So, up next, we have Brian Dietrich. He's with Woodard and Curran on behalf of the Fremont Regional Water Management Group. He'll present the scope of work and the development and how the group is progressing towards preparing the plan. Woodard and Curran has been involved in preparing the Antelope Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan, and they've also prepared the Indian Wells Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan. As we go through Brian's presentation, the group is hoping that the board might key on a few items, and I have three listed here. And if you look on bait stamp number 315, the top slide, Mr. Dietrich lists these three and a few other different key areas that he would hope that the board might key in on as he progresses through his presentation. So the first is the model scenarios. So the group intends to model changes in agriculture in the basin, changes in water quality as related to stormwater capture, and then changes as septic is converted to sewer. And we heard last month that California City intends under their LAMP program, or local agency management plan, to convert septic to sewer. So that'll be modeled. But are there any other scenarios that should be considered? And that's a question that we're hoping maybe to get some input on. And climate change adaptation and mitigation. What adaptations or mitigations might be applicable to incorporate into a salt nutrient management plan? For example, stormwater capture and having the infrastructure in place to get the big gulp. I heard that word at the High Desert Symposium. So capture that big gulp as it comes through and percolate it into the ground. Or invest in infrastructure. That could be an adaptation strategy, is to invest in the infrastructure to protect what you have already. And then the third that I have listed is the planning horizon. Should we plan out 20 years or 25 years? 25 years has been the norm for some of the past salt nutrient management plans. The IRWM plan is a 25-year horizon. But Sigma is sort of the up-and-coming, and that has a 20-year planning horizon. So we want to think about what might be an appropriate planning horizon for the salt nutrient management plan. So with that, I'm done. and we can hear from Brian the scope of work and how the group is developing the plan. But I'll certainly answer any questions if you have any of you right now.
Any questions from any member of the board? Thank you.
Brian Dietrich.
All right, thank you, Jan, and thank you to the members of the board for taking time tonight to really help provide us some direction from your experience in looking at salt nutrient management plans in the past and with your familiarity with the basin. We've really been doing this for a while. We've been involved with the Fremont Basin effort for about a year and a half. And right now we're at the point where we're about to put everything into the model, fix our assumptions, and really move forward with the technical aspect. So that's why we thought, well, now is a good time to pause and give some insights to the board on how we're approaching this before we get too much further down the road, and then we can incorporate, you know, some of your guidance. So we have done some of the technical work, not all of it, and we're kind of right in the middle of it right now. So that's why we're coming to you today. Okay. So the agenda looks long, but we're going to move quickly. I'm really just going to give you a little bit of background on the region and where some of our data is coming from so that you have confidence in that we're pulling that from the right places. We'll also talk about our modeling approach a little bit. I will give you a little bit of background on the hydrology of the basin, and we're talking about the Fremont Valley Groundwater Basin in particular. And then a little bit on performance monitoring, because that's important for a salt nutrient plan. And then finally, we'll end on schedule. I know Jan just mentioned schedule a little bit. I want to end on it because I want to make sure that you're comfortable with the schedule as well. It is somewhat aggressive. It is partly driven by our grant funding. So we have to stay within those constraints a little bit. But we can always ask for amendment from the state if it needs to be. Okay. And these are some of those key issues that Jan just mentioned. These are on a slide that you have in front of you. So it might be helpful to have that just in front of you as we go through this. I'm pretty loud, so I'm going to move here so I can actually see what you're looking at. So this is a map that shows the region and where we're talking about. There's a lot of different colors on there, so allow me to point some of it out. The green boundary, hopefully your printout is in color, the green boundary is the Irwin region. It looks a little different than the map that Jan just showed you because we're in the process of doing a boundary modification right now. The basis of that Irwin region boundary is threefold. Part of it is the shape it is because of the watershed, so the surface features in the region. But part of it is that shape because it follows the Fremont Valley groundwater basin contour. So it's a combination of surface feature and groundwater basin feature. And then in some small isolated cases, it's a political boundary, like the San Bernardino County line, for example. But for the most part, it's either a watershed outline or it's the Fremont Basin groundwater basin, Fremont Valley groundwater basin. And as Jan mentioned, this is really a process where we're doing three documents. There's the IRWIMP, which is the largest overarching document, and then that's being supported by two other documents, one of which is the groundwater management plan and the salt nutrient plan, which is what we're here to talk about today. Each one of those documents informs the IRWIMP, so they will end up being appendices to the IRWIMP itself.
Can I ask a question at this point?
Sure.
How are you allocating the dollars for this between these three different components of the plan?
The grant dollars?
Yeah, the $840,000.
It was submitted in a grant application. You want to
know? No, I mean sort of what percentage of that is going for the groundwater management plan? What percentage is for the salt nutrient management plan?
Oh, I see. Very roughly, it's about 25-25-50. But I would rather
50 being for the IRWIN?
For the IRWIN.
Okay.
I would rather give you the actual numbers if
I just want to follow up. That's fine.
Okay, that's a decent ballpark. Okay. You're not gonna be able to see this from where you're sitting, but this is just
good.
An overview of how water is introduced to and pulled from the groundwater basin. So what's happening is you have precipitation that occurs directly over and falls onto the groundwater basin surface itself, and that percolates down. Then you have precipitation that falls outside the basin, but in the watershed that drains down into the groundwater basin. So that is also recharging. We have imported water that comes in from the south, from Antelope Valley, East Kern. We have a little bit of underflow that is coming in from the Antelope Valley groundwater basin. And then, of course, we have pumping that occurs, and that's the main output from the basin. So when we do our modeling, this is how we start. We start with all the inflows and outflows to the basin and balance them.
So these pumping arrows should be three-dimensional coming out of the page?
This should all be three-dimensional. It would work a lot better.
Yeah. Okay.
One other important feature, you'll notice a dotted white line going right through the middle. That is the Muroc Fault. It's very important because that actually prevents the movement of groundwater between the lower half and the upper half. And so one of the approaches that we want to take to our modeling is to set these up as two separate subbasins. And so in a sense, we're going to have two different models, one for the south, which is called the Mojave City subbasin, and one for the north called the California City subbasin. Any questions on...
So in terms of the... more developed residential population, what percentage of it is above and what percentage below that fault?
Population, that I can't answer today. But it's all centered right around the fault, actually. That's right where California City is just north of that fault, and then you have the area served by Mojave, which is south of the fault. So this is another map of the groundwater basin, and you see a bunch of dots there. Each one of those dots represents a well that has some kind of water quality data. And these wells are particularly showing the total dissolved solids, or salts, concentrations. So I should back up for just a moment. The two constituents that we're concerned about with the salt nutrient plan are TDS and nitrate. So that's what we're focusing on. So that would be a good thing to get your blessing on today, that we've adequately covered the constituents that we need. So what you see there is there are some red wells and some yellow and some green. This represents each one of those dots represents the average of all data at that well location. So what you're not seeing here are the trends. This is just an average. This data goes as far back as the early 1900s in some cases. So this is just a broad overview here. We do have data that shows the trends, and generally speaking, basin-wide, the trends for TDS are coming down. And that's particularly true in recent decades. We think because agriculture peaked in the Fremont Valley in the mid-70s, and then it dropped drastically. And so that's probably why salts peaked and then are now coming down. And the same is true of nitrate. We have a map here that shows the nitrate wells too. There are barely any that are red. Red indicates over 10 milligrams per liter, which is the basin plan objective for nitrate. Very few wells, and again, those are long-term averages. Those wells are not at 10 currently. So we will show those long-term trends in the draft that we hope to get you in late June. So some of the data sources, we took a lot from public databases, state databases like USGS and CASGEM. Let's see if there's any other one to point out. There were also quite a few previous hydrologic studies, and so we took those that were done for California City in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Some of them included modeling. And so we built upon those for our model and just took it to the next level of detail. So I don't know if you want to go into detail on any of these data sources. We really tried to grab everything we could that was available. Okay. This is a build. This is a conceptual diagram. I think that's everything. Of the different ways that water and salt nutrient loadings move in the basin. I apologize. I'm used to speaking when I'm underneath the screen that I'm talking to, so this is really awkward. So in general, what you have is the groundwater basin. You have some underflow coming in from the left-hand side of the screen. And then from the top, various sources of irrigation flow. So some of it is just precipitation that falls and percolates. Other types of flows are deliberately irrigated, and that can be using AVIC water or pumped groundwater. That's pumped, irrigated, and then goes back in. We also have two wastewater treatment plants. One of them uses percolation ponds as a disposal method, so that obviously gets down into the aquifer. The other one reuses the water on a golf course and in a local lake, and so that also eventually percolates to the groundwater basin. And of course, we also have septic systems that are contributing. So all of these will constitute loadings of salts and nutrients into the groundwater basin, and that's what we're going to be estimating with our model. This is an example of how we calculate some of the land use loadings. So you can see on the map there are areas with different land use designations, and each one of those has an estimated loading of salt and nutrient that we can calculate using the salt and nutrient loading factor times the area. And so, again, this is just an example of some of the factors that we've pulled. If there are other factors that the board is more comfortable using, we certainly like to know so that we can adjust our calculations accordingly. The basic idea, again, is just that there's been a lot of research on, say, residential land versus commercial and what these loadings would be per acre. We're just taking those factors and applying them to the acres on the map.
So there's no legend here telling us what the colors in the map mean. Is that something that you can explain?
We took the legend off because there was too much on the slide.
Okay.
So the colors represent residential, commercial, agricultural, and which is which?
Yeah. So the blue blobs that are in the northern part, what is that telling me?
The blue blobs are commercial. The agricultural, yeah, this is why I don't like being so far away. I can't even see the colors. The agricultural is just left of the blue square at the top.
So it's kind of orange.
And then you've got a bunch of residential that's the orange-yellow color. That's California City.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then you also see in the far southern portion, that's the Mojave area. Okay, so then in addition to land use, we also have our wastewater treatment plants, and the same kind of approach is used here. We have typical concentrations of TDS and nitrate that come from a wastewater treatment plant. Same thing applies for septic systems, so we will apply those factors to the flow volumes that are coming from the treatment plants and coming from the septic systems. And so I included this. It's a lot of words in detail, but I wanted to put it all out there in case any of you have particular concerns about any of these topics. These are the primary assumptions that are going to be going into our model and how we're going to use them. So it doesn't necessarily have to come as feedback from you today, but at some point, you know, in the near future before we provide a draft to you, it would be good to know if, for example, nitrate volatilization, the factor that we're using for that is in agreement with the board. Or some of these other numbers that we have here look acceptable to you. We pulled these from, you know, standard literature. Some of them came from other salt nutrient plans that we've worked on. So we're pretty confident in these numbers. Give you a minute to look. Jen, I think you said the question came up about one of these numbers with staff?
No.
No? Okay. Okay. Move on? Okay. Okay, and so then what we'll do is what's called an anti-degradation analysis. I'm sure you're all familiar with what that is. For members of the audience who may not, it's simply taking a look at what the current water quality in the groundwater basin is, and then projecting forward in time what the future groundwater basin quality will be based on loadings that we think will happen as growth and other things occur over the Fremont Valley Basin. And what we'll end up doing is taking all the inputs and outputs, we will calibrate it using the changes in volume that have been recorded in the basin over time and the changes in concentration. And what you'll end up getting are two graphs, one that shows the basin plan objective as a horizontal line for TDS, and then what the trend will be according to our model. The hope, of course, is that, first of all, we're below the basin plan objective to start, and that we're going down or flatlining. I'm pretty sure that is going to be the case for TDS. If it is rising, then we will have to propose some mitigation measures, for what we're going to do in case it ever gets close to the basin plan objective. And then the same thing for nitrate. We'll do the same type of graph, basin plan objective, and then we'll show what the trend is over time. What I think we're proposing to do 20 years in the future, but if you want more than that, now is the time. It's easy to change now. So we're interested in your feedback on that. This slide is about future scenarios. So once we establish what the water quality is currently in the basin and what the trend is right now as a baseline, we thought, all right, well, what are some scenarios that could happen in the future that would significantly impact salt nutrient loadings? And one of them that we think is realistic is that agriculture might come back. I mean, agriculture is dependent on a lot of different, market forces, the cost of water, all kinds of things. But it is possible for a scenario to occur where ag expands again in the Fremont groundwater basin. And so one scenario that we'd like to do is to do a light, moderate, and heavy future ag scenario where they're increasing ag beyond what it is now. So that would increase the salt nutrient loading. It may be that we do that analysis and we still find that we're okay. We still find that there's enough assimilative capacity to handle those ag scenarios. If that's the case, we're probably done. But if we find that one or more of those ag scenarios actually causes a problem, then I think we'll look at things like septic conversions, which will decrease the loading, and maybe improving some stormwater capture, which would also, actually, technically speaking, it decreases the concentration, not the loading. But it would bring the concentration of the basin constituents down. So that's our proposed approach here, is that, first of all, we're going to do two sub-basins, not one big basin. We're going to project 20 years in the future. We're going to see what the baseline is according to all the data that we've been able to collect. And then once we have that established, we'll look at a light, a moderate, and a heavy ag scenario for the future. And we haven't defined those yet, but we're pretty close. If we still see no problem, then we're probably going to stop there. If we do see a problem, then we'll try some of these mitigations. Okay? And the last thing I wanted to talk about is performance monitoring. And so we've just begun to think about this. The reason I included this slide is just to remind everybody that the requirements for how many monitoring wells you should have in your performance monitoring plan is pretty consistent between what Sigma requires and what CASGEN requires. So we're probably going to follow their lead on this. And the bottom line here is for an area the size of Fremont, we probably need between 5 and 10 wells. And the slide after this shows we have plenty to choose from. So you see the map there. You see all the various different wells. They're color-coded so you can see who owns the wells. And they either have a triangle or a square around them, or both, if they're already measuring TDS and nitrate. So our approach will be, we're going to start with this pool of wells, and we want to select somewhere between 5 and 10 that have good geographic coverage, and that we're probably going to try to keep them within the regional water management group if we can. In other words, meaning we would probably prefer to have wells that California City owns or Mojave, just to keep it in the family. Now, if we can't get good geographic coverage doing that, then we'll expand it. But the idea would be to try to keep it within the regional water management. And then the last slide is just a repeat of the schedule. And so about a month ago, we met with staff, with Tiffany and Jan, and they gave us some really, really good feedback on what we should do to prepare for this meeting and also what we should be thinking about. And so then today in May, we're having this meeting with you. Our aim is to have a draft ready in either the end of June or maybe the first week of July. And then the full 30 days of July would be the review time for the regional board. So you'll have to tell us if that's too short, too long, or just right. And then after that, we would need a week or two to incorporate comments. There's usually some iteration back and forth, you know, on different topics with the board, at least in my experience in doing these. And then we would have a public review period starting in August sometime and going into September. Then we would produce a final from that, and hopefully your November meeting would be where we would finalize the entire thing. And I'm not sure if what that looks like exactly, if that would be a basin plan amendment or something short of that. Different regional boards handle it in different ways, and sometimes they handle different salt nutrient plans in different ways. So this is actually the topic I would most like input on. Because again, our schedule is somewhat dictated by our grant, which we can change, but it's a process. And so if we can stick to this schedule, that would be really fantastic. That's the end of my prepared statements for today, so I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Ms. Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the priority that DWR is assigned to this basin?
Low.
Low? Okay. That's the first question. There is a portion of this that's within Mojave Water Agency's boundary, just a very small area outlined. I think that's Randsburg or Red Mountain. Have you contacted them at all to see if they have any data that may be helpful for you?
We've been in touch with the Mojave region in general because of the region, the boundary change that we're going through. So we've actually had to be, we've been talking to Kern and Antelope Valley and Mojave. We have obtained groundwater data from RAND, CSD, but not from Mojave Water Agency. That's actually a good question. I don't think they have much overlap, but we can certainly ask.
We can help. The more data you get, the better.
Sure.
You had mentioned on the land use based assumptions that you're going to do the assessor categories and the aerial review. On the assessor categories, are those according to the county or the city's general plan? Is that how the categorization that the assessor has that you'll be evaluating?
So we actually use both. We used city and county. And the number of land uses that we started with was somewhere between 60 and 70, which is way too many for a salt nutrient management plan. And so the first thing we did was go through a process of combining the land uses that were similar into, I think we ended with 8 categories. And they were the ones that you think of, like commercial, residential, agricultural. It's not really useful to have incredibly detailed land use categories for this purpose. So we consolidated them into 8 categories using the county and the city.
And then as far as your question about the 20-year planning horizon, I think that's a fine planning horizon. And then on the septic conversions, do the cities of Mojave and California have policies regarding motivating their residents who are on septic to connect to the sewer?
They do, and not Mojave, but California City is currently engaged in their LAMP process. And so that's what we're looking to inform how we treat it in the model. And again, we may not even get there. We may not include any septic conversions unless we need it as a mitigation. I think it's probably important.
Well, this is just a wonderful study or suite of studies for this area, which is primarily disadvantaged. This is exactly what the grant funding is intended for, so congratulations to
thank you
and your group for doing
this. It's been a very rewarding process, and we're trying to get this all queued up for the first round of funding that's going to occur starting in the fall. And this region is more than 97% disadvantaged community. So there are more pools than usual to draw from.
And your last question on the schedule, that's really aggressive. I think we should, you know, facilitate that schedule as much as possible because the grant funding timeline is pretty important to adhere to. If you have problems there, you may not qualify or get a bad mark for future funding.
It would be nice and clean if we had all three documents ready.
Yeah.
And so you'll see there's nothing in October. I'm kind of leaving that as our float month. That maybe if we get delayed, we can still push into October for whatever we need. It's still aggressive, though.
Right. Well, I hope we can accommodate your needed schedule.
We appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Sandia? First, let me second Kimberly's remarks. I don't have much to add. It is curious that the TDS concentrations are coming down, and that's because ag is less active. Is it also because of both precipitation and AVEC water coming in? Or?
I think if you were to have a complete explanation, it is a number of factors. One, I mean, ag has drastically come down since 1976. And so, I mean, if they were at something like 10,000 acres, and now they're in the hundreds. So it's really, really different. That's also a good point, though, because AVIC service started in 1980. So that's another thing starting right around the same time that would contribute to bringing those TDS values down.
I had another couple of questions. First of all, let's go right to the schedule. It seemed to me that from the board's perspective, since we are not the ones doing the work, it's our staff, it's going to be the availability of staff to work with you that will, and to the extent that you need them to work with you, will be whether you can meet the schedule, whether we can be helpful enough to help you meet the schedule. I don't know. So how much time do you need from us?
Am I looking in the wrong direction? Should I be looking this way?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're happy for staff to share. This is extremely useful and worthwhile. We're happy to have the staff spend the time, but this isn't the only demand on their time.
Of course.
And so it's always a juggling act.
Let me ask you. Dan, is this doable?
We will do our best to work with the group to that we can. Certainly, yeah.
No vacations.
I got this.
And they've both been involved the entire year and a half. So they've been coming to stakeholder meetings and have been completely engaged in the process.
We have the best staff.
I just wanted to, make one point. Maybe you can share, I'm thinking about the TDS concentrations. Since the agricultural decline, groundwater elevations have significantly increased, and what is that change now? I can't recall.
What is the change?
Yeah. So how much did they come up?
It's a complicated question because it's different depending on where you are in the basin, and it's really drastically recovered in some parts and in others not as much. So wherever there's still ag, as you might guess, they haven't recovered as well. But that's something you'll see in the draft. You're going to see trends for groundwater levels. You're going to see trends for TDS, and then you'll see trends for nitrate.
For monitoring wells, is your plan that you will only use wells that exist, or do you think that there may be some places where you'll need to sink a new well just for monitoring?
Hopefully, it will not come to that. We have identified on that one slide 70 wells that we think are at our disposal.
Yeah.
Now, that probably won't turn out to be true. It'll be something less than that. But we should be able to get 5 to 10 with good coverage and with the right owners. That's our hope. If we don't, then we'll have to figure out what to do next.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jardine.
I do have to second Kimberly and Eric. I think this is very aggressive, but very positive, and we're able to meet the timeline. That's I'm totally in support.
Great, thank you.
The 20-year threshold is great.
Dr. Horne?
So this is really interesting. I have done some scenario planning in the past, and so I think in terms of trends as opposed to maps. And Board Member Cox already asked about, you know, whether you had looked at the general plans. So does that include looking at the population projections for that Kern County is projecting for the area and for the individual cities in the area to the extent that you know them and how that, and then also whether that's you know, population that is going to be in concentrated areas and on septic or on sewer and that kind of stuff.
So for if the population is used for water flow projections,
okay.
So to project what demands are going to be and therefore what supplies we're going to need, the general plans are used for land use projections so that we know what the type of land use is going to be and we know what salt nutrient loading to apply. So we're really using population and we're using future land use.
Okay. So the land use is going to change over the 20 or whatever the planning period
sure.
is.
Sure. And we only have what the plans say.
Right.
There's nothing else we have to look at.
Right. So what are you using for, what are your assumptions about the climate over the planning period?
Over 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
No change.
So the most recent research out of UCLA and Stanford, professors that are in those places, is that they are expecting more extremes in the weather pattern over time. So longer periods of drought, and then when the precipitation comes, it's going to come in greater intensity, which suggests that it might be worth looking at some different scenarios about climate over the planning period.
We can certainly do that. The recycled water policy that dictates the requirements of the salt nutrient plans actually does not include climate change at this point. However, the IRWIN certainly does, and SGMA certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention that the groundwater master plan, the groundwater management plan that we're doing, the whole intent of that is, we call it pre-SGMA. We're setting up the Fremont Basin to move on to SGMA at some point in the future when the state gets around to doing the low priority basins.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of taking them part of the way there, but not all of the way there. And when they do go all the way, there will be climate change requirements. So I guess the extent that to which we're addressing climate change is being done so far in the urban, not in the salt nutrient. But it would be possible to include a scenario in the salt nutrient.
I guess that's what I'm asking you to consider.
Okay.
It's another run, right?
It's another run, and it's a giant spreadsheet, so
yeah.
It's not terribly time-consuming to
yeah.
do. So,
yeah.
Okay.
I think that would be useful, because it might also inform land use decisions about stormwater capture, low-impact development, know where development occurs, that kind of stuff. Could point to some different directions that might be useful to know. I'm curious to draw you out a little bit more on the planning horizon about the pros and cons of 20 years versus 25 years, rather than just rubber stamping one number. So. I mean, I understand that all of our other salt nutrient management plans have used a 25-year planning horizon. So this would be different if it was 20 years. So why what are the pros and cons of
it? It's funny how this has evolved over time. So the letter of the law says 10, or not the law, the policy says 10. But since plans take time to develop and to get approved, we've usually used 15, or the older ones, the ones that got approved originally, used 15 just to make sure that by the time they were done writing the plan, they had a minimum of 10 beyond that date. So they just used 15. Then board started asking for, well, why don't we do 20? Let's go out a little further, and then 25. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. There's not a whole lot of difference between 20 and 25. You can have it be 25 if you see the benefit there. Personally, based on the way the model is development has gone, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of change at 20 or 25. So we're happy to do 25. To answer your question, I don't think there's a significant benefit one way or the other. It, usually they're trying to match the time frame of some other plan, like IRWAMP or Urban Water Management Plans. That's where the 20 came from, because they want to be in the same projection cycle as urban water management plans.
Okay, here comes Jan.
Please don't leave. Well, I just wanted to point out that the Sigma has a 20-year planning horizon.
Right.
So if Sigma is more of the wave of the future, to be more consistent with Sigma, the 20-year horizon would be consistent.
Okay. All right. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's more work to do 25 years than 20 years. So more information is always better than less. But on the other hand, there is some value. I mean, it's a toss-up to me.
Well, and the other thing to point out is modeling gets less
certain the further
certain
you go
useful.
Out. Yes,
the
no,
further
I know.
You go, the more the
right,
errors
I know
make
that.
A difference. And so that's another reason to constrain it. Not
yeah.
to less
yeah.
than 200 years.
Yeah,
you don't want to do that. Because somebody will see the results of that and think it's gospel. So we're happy to do it either way. I don't see a significant
yeah.
benefit or not to doing it either
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And Dr. Horn,
I don't have strong feelings about this.
Maybe if just of assistance to the dialogue, there's a draft recycle policy out by the state board for consideration, and in it they propose that the region boards evaluate the salt nutrient management plans for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have a new idea as a way of the future to allow functional equivalency in the salt nutrient management plan with the Sigma plan.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a closer knitting, if you will,
mm-hmm.
between that plan, Sigma,
mm-hmm.
and salt nutrient management plan in the future.
Well, that's a good idea, I would say. So enough of that topic. I like your scenarios of the three different areas of ag expansion. We've all been hearing about the increased interest in cannabis cultivation in the California City area. So, and then the pistachio, is that new there, or is that pistachios that have always been there?
They've been there since the 80s.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, it seems like pistachio generates more TDS than other crops. So I didn't know if there was a trend towards planting pistachios down there. So the different scenarios on ag expansion and the different scenarios on septic conversion, stormwater, that all looks good. So yeah.
Okay. And just so you know, we've been in communication with California City about the cannabis cultivation, and we've included that as part of the baseline.
Oh,
so
okay,
it's not a future scenario. It's actually, we're just assuming it's happening.
Okay.
They said it's this many houses, and you know, we figured we did some projections, and those are included in baseline.
Oh, one last question, since Mr. Sandell brought up monitoring wells. do you know the conditions of those wells, where the screens are, and all that kind of stuff? What, you know, what part of the aquifer they're pulling from and all that?
We have it for some, but not all. So it depends on the data. You know, USGS has pretty good information. CASGEM does. Not all the data sources have all that information. So just like how we would want to pick wells that are California City Mojave, we would want to try to pick wells that have that information.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Dias.
Yes, thank you. I only have 2 points to make. I think a 20-year planning horizon is appropriate here. Also, as Board Member Cox pointed out, this is an aggressive schedule, but I think it's the best route to follow if we're going to maximize our possibility for grant funding approvals. Other than that, good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for your presentation and also for the very hard work that's reflected in what you told us tonight. I want to thank our staff for being of assistance to you and commiserate with our staff for what lies in their future, since we're all in agreement that this is an appropriate development schedule. I have nothing to add other than comments that have been made by the board, and we look forward to seeing you again possibly in November.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Item 4 is public hearing, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Black Rock Fish Hatchery, Indian County. The California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahontan Region, will consider adopting an updated version of the current NPDES permit for the Black Rock Fish Hatchery. The permit is intended to address site-specific water quality issues and implementation issues identified by Water Board staff and California Department of Fish and Wildlife during the permit's current term. The board will proceed with a hearing on this item. The order of presentation for this hearing will be as follows. Presentation by staff, presentation by dischargers if they wish to provide testimony or evidence, and presentation by interested parties if they wish to provide testimony or evidence. All persons who wish to participate and have not yet submitted an appearance card are requested to do so now. This hearing will not be conducted according to the technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any testimony that is reasonably relevant to the matter under consideration. The chair may impose reasonable time limits and may require groups to choose a single spokesperson. We ask each person testifying to come to the lectern and speak. Please begin by stating your name and who you represent. So I'm going to start with the staff presentation on this matter.
Good evening, Chairman Humphreys, members of the board. I'm Rob Tucker, a senior water resource control engineer who works for the Lahontan Water Board. I will be presenting the Black Rock Fish Hatchery and with late revisions that you should have as well. Those are for Big Stamp, page 4-23 and 4-44 and 4-67. And I'm doing this presentation in lieu of Russell Norman, who's been ill. First, the permit was adopted, the very first one for this facility in 1975. It's been renewed 7 times. The NPDES program, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, requires permits to be updated every 5 years. Permits can be administratively extended up to 5 years. That's not the preferred option. The agreement with the state and federal EPA is that the State Water Board and the regional boards will maintain a 90% currency. On the monitoring did occur through this last 5 years, demonstrated the receiving water quality objectives were maintained. Sorry, I can barely see that, so you might want to look in your folders, as well as the next slide. Black Rock Fish Hatchery is south of here, just north of the town of Independence. It's adjacent to the Los Angeles Aqueduct, and it discharges into the Los Angeles Aqueduct as well. The primary water for the fish hatchery is from groundwater. There are two groundwater production wells on site. There is also a water diversion that is not controlled by California Fish and Wildlife. It's controlled by LADWP, and that's from Division Creek, and that flows into Pond 1, the fish hatchery area, and Pond 1 actually flows into Pond 2. There is a discharge into Pond 1, and that is from the incubation house that you see on the upper left-hand corner. There's a red arrow going to it. That's where they start the fish eggs, and that does discharge into Pond 1. Then we have four large raceways consisting of 20 isolated ponds within those raceways. And that groundwater is pumped into those raceways, not Division Creek, but groundwater. And once it finishes the raceway, it discharges into Pond 2, and then from Pond 2 goes to Pond 3, and after Pond 3, it discharges into the LA Aqueduct. The two large ponds, 2 and 3, and they are very large, are access settling basins. They're full of bulrush weeds, bulrush and other vegetation that help settable solids out. And this facility has never had a problem with settable solids or suspended solids. One thing I'd also like to note, the flow through the fish hatchery can be up to 30 CFS or 19 million gallons. It's typically only 15 to 20 million gallons. The aqueduct, the LA aqueduct, which it discharges into, is usually 177 million gallons to as high as 300 million gallons at peak flows. We did a number of major changes with this permit, and some of them were for prohibitions. We changed some limits, we changed some monitoring parameters, and monitoring frequencies. For prohibitions, one of them was for chemical use and drugs. We wanted to prevent or avoid synergistic effects, so we said no more than one chemical at a time. We also added, with potassium permanganate, we said only two raceways at a time to avoid a reasonable potential in the receiving water. With hydrogen peroxide, we actually removed and said they could treat all four. We reevaluated and said they wouldn't exceed a reasonable potential, so they are allowed to do that. So we removed the one raceway at a time, and they can treat all four if wished. Then we looked at some limits that we changed. pH, that was one that we did revise. We had them with a set standard range, and when we read the basin plan, we're saying, no, they can't change the receiving water. So it's more flexible for their pH standard. It's not that they have to be in a set range, but they can't change the receiving water. And we did that because sometimes the receiving water is really high, sometimes it's really low. It's their ability to change it is what's more important. We also had dissolved oxygen requirements, coliform requirements, total residual chlorine, and temperature. These are not on effluent. These were all receiving water limits that we really targeted. The other changes were, again, monitoring parameters. We looked at their data, and we realized they had some really good quality water. So we reduced electrical conductivity. There is no direct limit associated with electrical conductivity. You can make correlations to TDS, but there's no limit. So we removed that as a monitoring parameter. Hardness, we changed to once a month, but only when they're applying potassium permanganate, not a regular basis. We did add hardness for receiving water monitoring once a year, so we reduced that. Total recoverable manganese, again, we changed that to once a month, but only when they're applying potassium permanganate again. For monitoring frequencies, all the reductions that we did do were based on the quality of data that they have, not just the quality, but how that is associated with the receiving water limits and their effluent. So we went from quarterly to annual for a number of constituents in receiving water. For influent, we went from quarterly to annual again for a number of constituents. This is all based on their quality of data and what it showed to us about receiving water limits. And finally, effluent, we made a number of changes to quarterly monitoring, quarterly to annual, Some of those constituents, I'm just going to rattle off. I didn't want to rattle each one off, so we weren't sitting here all night. So for boron, fluoride, nitrate, total nitrogen, sulfate, those are some of the constituents we're looking at. And we also based some of the effluent, went from monitoring to annual for TDS, chloride, and ammonia as well. What did we add? And we did add some requirements. Thank you. With the monitoring work, the chemical of drug use, we want to know on a quarterly reporting what they're using. Also, what they're not using. They gave us a large list of chemicals that they use, or pharmaceuticals. These aren't for the fish. And so we want to know what they're using, what they're not using. Also, on an annual basis, we added the feeding versus production. So we know how much their food stock they're providing and how much is going to their fish production. And that gives us a good balance ratio so that we know that they're not overloading with feed. And then the last thing we did add was priority pollutant metals monitoring. That requirement was to put a monitoring plan together and submit to the board. So I have a couple of changes here. In the monitoring parameter frequencies, let me back up. So we made a number of changes. We did receive one comment letter from California Department of Fish and Wildlife. That's Enclosure 3, the part of your board package. And no other comments were received by either federal or U.S. EPA or other stakeholders during our public notice process. We attempted to collaborate with CDF, and I think in our enclosure number 3, we clarified and accepted a lot of their comments. And there were several comments that we did make changes in here, too. We removed organophosphate from influent effluent receiving water monitoring. We also changed soluble solids and total suspended solids from monthly to quarterly sampling. And that's based off of, we also changed in this permit, this was originally in this permit shown as water quality objectives in the last permit. We're updating it. These are actually should be based off technology-based effluent limits for this permit as being an aquatic animal facility. And those, we did inform them that when we reduce this monitoring frequency that they should be aware that as technology-based effluent limits, these are monthly limits, average limits. So if they sample, they should really try to sample early in the period and realize that they have to try to, if it was a mistake, they need to resample several times. Otherwise, it will be a violation for 3 months instead of 1 month for the quarter. After our comments, we tried to work, again, collaborate with Cal Fish and Wildlife, and they've made some other requests which we are going to evaluate during the course of this permit. One of their concerns was also, again, with dissolved oxygen. I had to clarify that it's receiving water quality changes, not that they're responsible for what's in the receiving water, what changes they may make to the receiving water. They also requested total suspended solids and settleable solids to be potentially removed from effluent limits. We're going to evaluate through this next permit, so we did not remove those, but that's something that will be evaluated based off their data collection over this period as well as the next period. And when I say period, 5 years for the permit cycle. One of their other questions which came up, and I will apologize to Fish and Wildlife a little bit, some misunderstanding between us, was their lost pit and their historic practices. In that, the lost pit is where they dispose of dead fish. And we have historically got a plan from them, but we didn't evaluate it. And so we were going to say this is not a prohibited action. When I reviewed their material again during this correlations, we downplayed that. We're going to go back with Fish and Wildlife, get with the county, review all the regulations, and see if their best management path is acceptable. I looked at it, and it's where they dispose of it today. It's a very small pit, and they say it lasts several years. So we're going to evaluate whether it's within the requirements and legal, instead of saying it's prohibited just because we had a new staff looked at it and said, he didn't know about it,
and decided to say it's prohibited. So we're reevaluating that, and we did make that change, so that's something in the order. The last misunderstanding is the metals, monitoring plan for priority pollutant metals. And in that one, through the course of this permit, at the end of the permit, that was one of the issues that came up very late, was getting that material, that data to us. So we put in a pretty strict requirement of submitting a plan ahead of time to reduce any potential error. Give them a here's a reminder of getting a metals monitoring plan in place that it will work for the requirements in the order. And that was the last thing we were working on, but it's one thing we want to reduce the potential for error by human factors. Ooh, I turned it off.
Here. Quick presentation.
Well, that's the end. If I have any questions, and I would recommend it, but I know you have one comment.
Thank you. I think what I'd like to do is take questions of the staff presentation now. Mr. Dias?
Yes, thank you. I have some questions regarding your slide number 4, if you can pull that up.
This one?
Yes, thank you. As I understand it, the fish hatchery is receiving water from the aqueduct and then discharges back into the aqueduct, correct?
Okay, for the hatchery itself, we just looked at the raceway and incubation, which is what Fish and Wildlife work with, does not receive any LA aqueduct water. They get a diversion in the upper right corner from Division Creek. That's controlled by LA DWP. They don't control that. It does go through their part of their settling process, but I want to make a distinction so you realize they don't get a control of Division Creek, which is, so that will feed LA aqueduct. So none of theirs comes from LA aqueduct, but they do discharge into LA aqueduct. And the facility itself is owned by LADWP. They lease their equipment.
One final question. What is the purpose of the two groundwater pumping wells if there's water available from Division Creek?
My impression is they aren't allocated to use. Well, there's two things. First, I don't know if they're allocated to use Division Creek. But Division Creek, they used to use Pond 1 as part of the fish hatchery. It now has an infestation of snails. So they're using groundwater so that it's not in contact with those snails. And the raceways don't receive any water from Pond 1 as well. What the Division Creek does do is help dilute any kind of discharge they have of pharmaceuticals because they're using that Pond 1. So there's a benefit for them, but that's not something they control. So the real reason for groundwater probably now is to avoid the snails and allow them to ship their fish more freely. If they had any fish mixing in with the snail population, then they'd have more prohibitions on where they can put it within their rules.
Okay, I have no further questions. Thank you. Good presentation, Rob.
Thank you. Dr. Hort.
I just had one question. I believe I read it in the material, but which is why orthophosphate was removed. You didn't explain that tonight. But I think I know the answer, but I just want you to say it.
You probably know the answer better than I do. my assumption is that they didn't either find it in their effluent or they ceased using that particular pharmaceutical.
Yeah, okay.
But I will, that's one I don't know as well.
All right. Thanks. That's all.
Research work together.
Mr. Jardine.
No questions. Excellent presentation.
Mr. Sandell.
I noticed that there was a really long list of chemicals and pharmaceuticals that can be used in the raising of fish, not all of which are used at this facility. But I went through the material fairly carefully, and I could not find any information about what happens, what's the fate of these chemicals when they're used, how long before they break down into something completely benign. It doesn't seem that any steps were taken to make that happen.
to assume that they're released into the water stream, but of course it's very low concentrations. Can you shed any insight on that?
No, but we did have a long discussion, Fish and Wildlife said, what is it where it was no longer detectable? So I gave them four scenarios with my limited knowledge. I said, one, what's prescribed to where the ingredient is no longer considered active or have a synergistic effect? Now, I realized that was kind of a double-edged sword because most of the chemicals, they don't know if there's a synergistic effect. But so the first thing is, what's the prescription within the chemical or the manufacturer that is no longer active? So the other is some chemicals, hydrogen peroxide, we know is a very short time frame. So that one, again, we reduce. And then the third would be, you know, you're getting a full flushing, or if how much flow, because these are continuous flow rate of fish hatcheries, so they're not pulsing. So how much flow would throw it? And then Cal Fish and Wildlife said, well, what if we use localized field testing that's prescribed with chemicals? Because some chemicals may have that. Hydrogen peroxide, you probably could do pH testing. I said, yes, that would be appropriate. But the ultimate for us is not the raceway, but actually pond 3. So, yes, we have a dilution of 10 CFS or more. I can't remember how many million gallons. That's from Division Creek. And then you also have that dilution once you hit at least tenfold into LA Aqueduct. So, but knowing each specific chemical on their lifespan, we did not research that. No,
no, and it seems to me realistically that the concentrations are going to be so tiny by the time you get up into the aqueduct and on downstream that it probably has no consequence. But some chemicals, very small amounts, can have an effect, you know, the hormone analogs. So it's a matter of interest. You know, we have to kind of wind up from the drinking water in that way.
No, that will research. I know that was not the target of what we were looking at in this permit, but I'm taking that as input for that in the future because we have three other permits.
Thank you.
Ms. Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This sounds like this has been a very positive and iterative process in arriving at the new guidelines. I did have a question on the pharmaceutical that you presented, slide number 7. You had mentioned pharmaceuticals. How exactly, excuse the naivety of the question, is this used in a fish hatchery environment?
I'm an engineer who does wastewater treatment. So I looked at that list, and it was, I know that list actually was one of the comments. They added like 3 or 4 after the report of waste discharge that we worked with our contractor to add in. So to answer your question, I don't know those answers. I can get you that, and I will work on it for the next board if you want that. That'll give me something to present in July.
Well, it's just curious because in the water side, the pharmaceuticals and the PTEs are such a hot button because it's challenging, if not impossible, to treat those and remove them from the potable water supply. So, just a curious question.
We might be able to get to that in the next presentation. I have no questions. Thank you. Call for presentation by the discharger. I do have a card from Mr. Terry Jackson from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. You are forewarned. There may be a question for you.
I reckon there will probably be so.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair and Board. Thank you for letting me speak here. My name is Terry Jackson. I am the statewide MPDS coordinator and well as Homeland Security. I threw that one on me as well for all of our hatcheries, all 23 hatcheries around the state. So I work with the Hunt Board, the North Coast Board, all three subsections of the Central Valley Board, and luckily I don't work with the LA Board. We do have a facility in Los Angeles, but it doesn't have a discharge to the river. But so in my case, I get the chance to read every single permit, and so I know I'm a challenge to the water board that's spoken to you before. I thank you. I can be a real challenge because I do read 20 permits or NOAs, and I'm a kind of a stickler for detail, and I kind of would really like things to be nice if everything was similar, even if, you know, as long as it fits within the basin plan. So, and I will be glad to answer the questions you just asked. And but in particular, I'd like to thank Rob Tucker and Russell Norman. They really took some time to work with me. I know there was some confusion with the comments that I provided, and we were able to work through what I was actually trying to get at versus, such as the priority pollutant metals. I wasn't saying don't do priority pollutant metals. It was, and I'll talk a little bit about that, on what I was asking in particular. We are glad that our water quality is good. Black Rock is a very clean facility. All of our facilities are clean. We are a resource agency. We raised the canary, so to speak. The rainbow trout is probably one of the wimpiest fish as far as, you know, diseases and whatevers. And so if we do something in our facility that kills a fish, you know, that's a big deal, obviously, to us. We're in the business of raising fish, not killing fish. So the wasp pit, you know, we have a small wasp pit because we sure don't want to use it. And so we're very efficient with our feed because that's, we're all on tight budgets. We're not interested in having food go down to the pond because anything that leaves the raceways means that we wasted money. So our staff are extremely well trained and take care of those things. So indeed, this permit is much improved. We're very grateful for this permit, an opportunity to reduce some of the sampling efforts, which saves some money, reducing sampling. You asked about orthophosphate. Orthophosphate is a nutrient that we do not add to the water. And of course, there was never anything there. Not to mention, it's an extremely difficult test to perform, of course, filtering of the water, et cetera. We've asked that on other permits in the past, and now this just comes in line with other permits. We're very grateful to have that removed. Appreciate the late revision regarding executive officer. I realize that Patty is very busy. I mean, I can't imagine how many things maybe do or don't come to her desk. And so I know that if I were to send everything I do to the director of Fish and Wildlife, that it would probably sit on his desk for Lord knows how long. So I appreciate that, you know, kind of spread the work out a little bit and have somebody that way. At least we know that somebody reviewed it. In the past, we've just presumed that, you know, if nobody questioned our practices, it must be okay. We submitted the plan and nobody questioned it. So it's nice to have something, we'll have something solid that we know for sure, reported on it. So my biggest challenge, I guess, just my last piece is, you know, we talked about the priority pollutant metal plan. And so the challenge we have with the plan is, and it wasn't that we didn't comply with the priority pollutant metal sampling. We did actually comply with it. The challenge we had, and thankfully Russell did reduce the stringency in Table J, the water quality objectives that we were supposed to meet with our priority pollutant metals, was drinking water objectives, which is very difficult, obviously, for us to meet in the way that things are changing. So we actually sampled the water the first time on time, as we were supposed to. However, the lab did not run the water at the stringency required. Therefore, you know, we were not able to provide the data necessary to the board. I mean, we provided it, but it wasn't good enough, so we had to do it again, and we actually had to do it a third time before we finally got a lab that could meet the criteria. And I think we still were kind of close on mercury, maybe, or something like that. There was one parameter that one of the metals that we were pretty tough on. The challenge we have with the monitoring plan, the specific language, locks us in by September 1st of 2020. It locks us into identifying the contract laboratory or laboratories selected to conduct the monitoring plan. And we're having a real challenge. We don't know who's going to be certified. You know, every time the EPA changes things or the state board changes regulations, we're having a hard time finding labs that were certified that are still certified. We're losing them right and left. And even our water pollution control lab in Rancho Cordova, who does a lot of the ELAB certified sampling even for the water board, is having a hard time finding labs that they can sub to. And we never know in advance whether or not the lab that was certified will be certified. So right now, in fact, I'm writing a contract for all 11 facilities in the Central Valley. And, you know, I'm just now putting it out for bid to sample the next fiscal year. So the only challenge I have, I don't have a problem with writing the plan saying, hey, we're going to follow everything that's in the permit. It's being locked into a specific contractor because I can't guarantee with the way the state works on how quickly I can get a bid out to the contractors, somebody, et cetera. So that's the only challenge I had. And Rob and I have talked about that, and we'll work through whatever that is, but that was my biggest thing. So with that, that's really all I have to say tonight. I want to thank the water board, thank you, Rob and Russell in particular, and Ben as well. We had an opportunity to talk with him on the phone. And so anyway, I appreciate the opportunity. I'll shut up and answer questions.
Thank you, sir. Let me ask if there are any questions from members of the board. Ms. Cox.
So in my question of pharmaceuticals, it's because the rainbow trout are wouldn't.
Well, yeah, as far as compared to, say, a bass or a bluegill or a warm water species, right? So if you look on in attachment G, that's all of the approved, in this permit, attachment G has all of the approved drugs and chemicals. That's a toolbox. Very few of those drugs and chemicals have we ever actually used at Black Rock. It's just that we have veterinarians and pathologists that they come and look at the fish. They identify what disease is happening or what parasite is going on. And it's nice to have a toolbox full of things to use. But they don't use all of them. In fact, most of them on this list they don't use. And you can see that. So there's some of them that are a bath, where they'll just have a tub and the fish are put into a bath. Some of them are treated actually in the raceway, such as with potassium permanganate or hydroperoxide is treated in or put into the water at 100 parts per million. And by the time it gets through the system, it's down to nothing. In fact, hydroperoxide is typically down to zero by the end of the raceway. Most of our chemicals are either bound by organics, bound by the sediments. They're also dissipated as they tumble through any kind of an aeration system. They'll be dissipated in the air. Some of them are broken down by a UV. So anyway, there's a process that breaks them down. And everything that we use is established by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That's all set. And so it's very rigid for the whole United States on what is allowed. So we don't do anything. That's why our veterinarians are certified. No different than if you were to take your dog to a vet or certify it on how certain drugs are used. Some of them are actually injected into the fish. So.
Thank you for the education. I know more now about trout. My second question, Chair, is for Patty. Do we have the ability to offer the applicant a little more flexibility on the laboratory issue?
Yeah, I think we might be able to. I'll ask Rob Tucker if he wants to address that.
This was one of our misunderstandings, and we really tried to narrow what Fish and Wildlife agreed. So we did have some proposed language that we could provide him. Kathy, can you pop that slide up that I put earlier? The next page.
Okay.
That one?
Yes.
Oops. So what we did here was we worked on it, and instead of actually specifying the contract lab, telling us to specify 3 months prior to sampling. So his monitoring plant will commit to using a contract lab, not a specific one, and then he'll notify us 3 months prior. And that version has one typo in it. The capital T should be after priority pollutant. Let's see.
that discharger should be a small T.
And that's up to you, the board members, if they wish to change.
Go ahead, counsel.
Sorry, this is Elizabeth, your counsel. And to get to your question about whether we can, I think this is a logical outgrowth of some of the original permit, and wouldn't be a change that would require recirculation. So it is something that we could consider today.
Thank you. May I inquire of Mr. Jackson if that's addresses your concern?
Yes, it does. Of course, we would use the ELAB certified lab. We just don't know which one.
Well, it's always nice to see things come together. Mr. Sandell? I'm sorry, Ms. Cox.
No, I'm done. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Sandell?
Thanks very much for the information.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions.
Dr. Horn?
So these are just questions for Mr. Jackson now, or comments on?
I'm just asking for questions of the presentation by the discharger. We'll come to comments at a later point in time.
I have no questions, thank you. Actually, I do have a question. It's kind of a silly question, but I have to ask it because I'm curious. So the permit updated the beneficial uses from simply coal to cold water with spawning, warm, and warm water with spawning. So my cheeky question is, are you planning to raise bats or some warm water fish at this fish hatchery?
No, we're not. I'm not really sure. My attitude was I didn't care. But, I mean, that's not part of what we were. So maybe backtracking a little quick on that Division Creek issue at Pond 1. Division Creek also discharges directly into the aqueduct by itself. Okay, so it comes off the mountain and down through, and so we get a piece of it through Pond 1. It's got not only the snails, but it also has whirling disease in it. And so we've actually quit using that pond the way we used to. We used to actually, the hatchery used to actually spawn the fish there and utilize those fish, and we don't use that pond anymore. That even that incubation house basically says quiet now because of the issues. But the pond, the water we get from LADWP, the wells are pumped specifically by LADWP, and then we use those in our raceways. We actually pump a lot less now. There was a lawsuit that required LA to pump less water for some groundwater issues, primarily for botanicals. They wanted to recharge, bring that water table up for the botanicals, which has been effective. So anyway, that water is totally clean. So that's kind of how that process. So I don't know about the beneficial uses, but no, we don't have any intention to do that.
Mr. Dias, any questions?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I have no questions, Mr. Jackson. Thank you very much for your presentation. Call for presentation by any other interested persons. I have no more cards. I'm scanning the faces in the audience, and I'm thinking there may not be anyone who fits in this category, but if there is, please come forward at this time. Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close the hearing and ask for comments from the board members as deliberation on this matter, discussion, starting with Mr. Dias.
I'm very pleased with the permit as presented. I have no comments.
Dr. Horn.
So I was impressed with this permit and the revisions in it. It shows that a lot of thought and care was put into revising this permit from both Fish and Wildlife and the Lahontan staff. The issue of pharmaceuticals and synergistic effects for being a water quality engineer, you did a very good job, I think, Mr. Tucker, because really I thought the solution of only having one chemical or drug used at a time until it was no longer found in the the effluent is a good policy. So that allays my concerns on that issue. So all in all, it was a very thoughtful and thorough job, so thank you very much.
Mr. Jardine.
No, total support. Very good.
Ms. Cox.
No further comments.
Mr. Sandell.
Nothing to add to the previous comments.
Chair would entertain a motion.
Chair, before you entertain a motion, I just wanted to clarify when you make your motion, if you want to include the pink sheet, the revised changes, and also the proposed revision that was discussed today and is on the PowerPoint right now. I want to just read into the record the page numbers if you were considering the PowerPoint and where that change would be.
Thank you.
The first one would be on fate stamp page number 449. This is of the monitoring and reporting program. Page E7 under section Roman numeral 9C. And it would include a strikeout of the words, the plan shall also identify the contract laboratory or a laboratory selected to conduct the monitoring and demonstrate that they are. And then include an additional language saying, 3 months prior to collecting the required priority pollutant metal samples, the discharger shall notify the water board of the, and then the rest of the language would continue. The other location that this change would occur on is base stamp page number 4118 of the priority pollutant metals monitoring requirements, page J1, section 3. And the strikeout and the additional language would be the same language that I had just previously indicated.
Thank you. Is there a motion?
I move that we adopt the proposed NPDES with the late revisions indicated in the pink sheet and the late revisions just read into the record by the staff council.
I'll second the motion.
Been moved and seconded. Call for a roll call.
Member Cox?
Aye.
Member Dias?
Aye.
Member Horn?
Aye.
Member Sandell?
Yes.
Vice Chair Jardine?
Yes.
Chair Pumphrey?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you all. It's always nice to sit up here and see people come and say, we were able to work this out, and we're working well together. It's very much a pleasure. It makes our jobs so much nicer. Item 5 on the agenda is climate change mitigation and adaptation update. This is an informational item to the board.
Good evening, Board Chair, members of the board. I'm Mary Fiore Wagner, a senior environmental scientist in your South Lake Tahoe office. And tonight I'll be presenting item number 5 in your agenda packet. It is an informational item updating you on our progress towards developing our strategy on climate change mitigation and adaptation. With the presentation, I'll review the development steps in the process, stakeholder involvement along the way, acknowledge actions that are completed, underway, and others that are proposed. Then I'm going to switch gears and I'll update you on the State Board's progress towards implementing its comprehensive response to climate change, and this was formalized in a resolution last March that was adopted. And then we'll see where our efforts align with the State Board's process, and then finally I'll share key considerations in the development of our strategy. Here is a timeline of our major steps along the way. This graphic shows the process from its inception, shows where we currently are, and our endpoint. Tonight, I actually, right now in our process, we're at the technical working group phase, and I will focus on that later in the presentation. Advance. So you've seen this a few times. Each time it gets a little bigger, so that's nice, more stakeholder involvement. It has been the cornerstone of our process. Both the board and the staff early on with climate change, our strategy, we acknowledge that we are part of a larger structure of individuals and agencies that are also adapting to climate change. So those responses, in some cases, they are very different and they're protecting different interests. So we realize that if we are transparent along the way and we engage with the public and stakeholders, we'll have better success in developing solutions that effectively respond to climate change. And in some cases, we actually, there might be a nice balance between these competing interests. So throughout the process, we've allowed opportunities for people to get involved. We've had a good cross-section of people participating, citizens, tribes, federal, state, and local governments, consultants, non-governmental organizations, land trusts, and even other regional board members. And they've taken part in our workshops, our outreach meetings, and our surveys. And we also have over 170 people on our layers list. They keep updated on our past activities and also upcoming work. I'd love to always bring this back to you. Jeff Smith was first to present it. Get your binoculars out. So moving back to steps within our process, in May of 2015, we presented the board with a conceptual model. This was our initial roadmap for adapting to climate change. For color's sake, it might be easier to look at it this way. Red outline is existing regulations, purple font is existing policies, and blue font is existing assessments. And what this did for us, it was a snapshot in time, and we took stock of existing tools that we currently had in place, both statewide and regionally. And it helped us realize that we already have a lot in place that we're doing, and we're making progress on key issues. But it also helped us realize there's gaps, and in some instances we recognize that we may just have to do slight modifications to embed climate change considerations into some of these policies and permits. Okay, this slide shows actions that we have already completed. So they exist to us today. To indirectly, we're mitigating greenhouse gases. For example, the revised permitting process for renewable energy projects, that's helping to diversify our energy sources. So there are more opportunities to reduce dependence on fossil fuel. And then we're also adapting to climate change impacts through emergency preparedness, both with our timber waiver and also the debris removal waiver. And there's measures to protect water supply and also water quality. We see that in part with the Bishop Creek bacteria study that's going on, and also for groundwater basin protection with cleanup and replacement orders that have been issued, and also salt nutrient management plans that have been already adopted and ones within development. Okay, now for actions that are underway or developing. This is where we can mesh climate change considerations into our actions. So for permitting, the general order for LADWP maintenance, we want to make it more efficient because those maintenance activities we acknowledge may be increasing with more flashier floods coming, more debris being delivered. So this will hopefully help move that along a little quicker. And then monitoring. This has been a huge part of my workload lately. And just today I met with the Bishop Paiute Tribe to secure their facility for our HAB workshop that we'll be hosting in June. Really excited about that. this is receiving a lot of attention statewide, and it is a new issue that we're dealing with in our region, whether or not there's more awareness about harmful algal blooms, but we are seeing them increase throughout our region. And unfortunately, I have to share that we actually had a detection reported in the Tahoe Keys from samples that were collected last week. This is brand new news. And to the point where we recommended that they place caution signs. So that's a little telling and scary, but anyway. Groundwater basin protection, encourage these remaining salt and nutrient plants to come through. And also the groundwater sustainability plans that will be developed for our high and medium groundwater basins in the Lahontan region. We can use this information to our advantage as we develop policies that will help with protecting groundwater quality and also supply. Going back to the steps, is way back in December 2015, we formed internal working groups, and this was staff volunteering to participate. These groups focused on three priority areas that were identified by the very first science workshops and brainstorming. And we've seen that those areas of focus have been supported. They remain consistent with what we hear through the survey results and outreach meetings. So those groups are focusing on protection and restoration of wetlands and floodplains, protecting infrastructure and protecting critical recharge areas, and increasing stormwater treatment and infiltration, and increasing low-impact development. The purpose of these internal working groups largely now is identifying partners that we can work with in this technical working group phase. So we realize others out there are doing great work that we can, we also want to focus on some of the areas where they're doing work, so we want to leverage their efforts and maximize any outcome from that. So we want to tap into planned or existing efforts and play more of a non-traditional role as a partner and not the regulator. So you see funding is kind of embedded in all of this, and you know, we realize that funding plays a large part on the pace and success of developing strategies, not only for us, but for partners. So one thing we have worked on through our LIRIS list we distribute, if anything comes across my inbox that has to do with funding that might have a nexus to climate change, I push it out to the LIRIS list group. So they're just aware. It's more information sharing to the group, so they are aware of those opportunities. So now, moving on to focusing to where we are now in the process, these technical working groups. The focus represent our overarching goals and the areas of focus that were largely supported through consensus. The purpose of the technical working groups that we hope to start engaging with individuals this summer would be start fleshing out details of proposed key actions, building productive partnerships, and providing a focused venue to interact with the regulated community and stakeholders. Three areas where we will do this would be infrastructure and critical recharge area protection. Two of the select actions that we could consider would be looking at vulnerability and risk assessments and adaptation plans to then get what was identified through those vulnerability assessments to actually happen, put them in place. Another would be to expand prohibitions to protect sensitive environments, and that would be critical recharge areas, perhaps expanding the Tahoe and Truckee prohibitions that are already in place. Maybe that our southern region could benefit also from that in desert washes or areas identified as critical recharge. For wetlands and floodplains, the need to streamline permitting for meadow restoration would be a select action. Also, developing criteria for grazing management on both public and private lands. We could do that by partnering with both RCDs to get to that private sector. As far as then for stormwater and LID, we could revise permits to maximize stormwater treatment and infiltration. What we heard largely from outreach sessions was, first, we want to start with LID education. People want to know what's going on, what's effective. So first educate and then find the mechanism, the tool, to help the LID be implemented more throughout our region. And there's many entities, as you can see, or not see, that we can partner with along the way. For infrastructure, it would be wastewater treatment facilities, the groundwater management agencies, local governance, and the regional RCRCs, which is the Regional Council of Rural Communities. Thank
rural
you.
Counties.
And then IRWIMS, of course, for stormwater LID. Okay, so we have said within our strategy we do want to identify a schedule of select actions that we could actually begin working on within a short horizon, within the near future of 1 to 3 years. And this strategy, so it would identify a subset of tasks. So this is just an idea moving forward. This would be one of a suite of many things that could be looked at. But this is an area where a technical working group could come together and look at for protecting infrastructure. How could we get there? Well, we could survey. We could learn what's already being done out there. Our assessments being done. What are the findings of those assessments? It would also be valuable for us to develop criteria to identify critical areas, perhaps where we would want to see at-risk areas make improvements. What I mean by that is, has there been a history of failure? Was there a recent wildland fire? Are these areas going to be vulnerable? We would review the survey results from the wastewater treatment plants on their at-risk areas, and then schedule technical working group meetings with these individuals that would be affected by any actions we move forward with. And the next step would be, how do we then craft a tool to implement repair, replacement, increased maintenance, or complete relocation, if that is the best option. One, maybe we do it through just monitoring and reporting plan, where they report to us what they have done as far as relocating and repair of those at-risk areas that have been identified. And then, you know, if we had to, I guess we could go forward with enforcement if there was a known threat to surface water, or there was a threatened discharge to surface water. Again, another overarching goal of this strategy would be to increase protection and restoration of wetlands, floodplains, and headwaters. One way to do this would be to streamline the process and permitting to allow the pay scale and efficacy of these projects to move forward. So there's a unique opportunity here to leverage and engage with an existing effort underway, Sierra Meadows Partnership, there's the California Tahoe Conservancy and TRPA, Forest Service, the Lake Tahoe West Restoration Project, but Sierra Meadows Partnership especially, they've identified areas throughout the greater Sierra Nevada in both the Region 5 Water Board and our Regional Board that these meadows are degraded, where we have opportunities to restore them. One, that will help increase the carbon sequestration among multiple benefits that you would get: biodiversity, metering flows during high water events, and groundwater recharge and attenuation. So what we could do there first would be to collaborate with the Sierra Meadows Partnership. And one thing we'd want to do is get an inventory of these projects. They want to move forward, Sierra Meadows Partnership. Their strategy is 30,000 acres of restored high alpine meadows within the next 15 years. And that was kind of came in 2017. That is a huge pace, which means that's a workload that we would have to absorb. How can we make that more efficient? First, we want to survey of those projects what would be 5 acres or less, because that CEQA documentation would be a little easier. It could be a categorical exemption because it's small habitat restoration. For ones that were bigger, we may want to look into a programmatic CEQA. We may want to identify actual elements and conditions that could be written into a project. The elements that become part of the project and assure us that there won't be water quality impacts. Those can be conditions that would be satisfied as the application comes forward, and that would help streamline. And then one other thing that has come up in our region is the inability sometimes to meet our stringent turbidity water quality objective. It's a challenge for some of these restoration projects, especially during the construction phase, to meet that turbidity requirement. So maybe working with Fish and Game to, you know, learn what are the real impacts of that. Is there any latitude to work with that, you know, while still aligning with our mission of protecting water quality? And yeah, so that's that. I did want to mention we are trying to work with some of the practitioners for Sierra Meadows partnership and maybe provide a CRAM training, 2-day refresher, to build the capacity of those partners as well. So we're confident that the assessments that they're doing to see if the projects are successful, they're confident in making those assessments and reporting back. And finally, with another overarching goal, increasing stormwater infiltration and treatment and low-impact development. So for low-impact development, I'll focus on low-impact development. What I see here is an opportunity to leverage existing tools, and that would be gathering an first, we want to gather an inventory of the new development projects that might be proposed, more likely probably in our southern region, where projected population growth is going to occur in our region, more so than the north. So what is the scope of that? Because those development projects are where we're going to have an opportunity to implement some of these LID approaches. So we can also leverage information from cities and counties. This might be something that the gentleman working on the Fremont plan could use. These cities and counties, through SB 379, they have to incorporate and identify. They have to do a vulnerability assessment for their locality, and then they have to actually identify adaptation and resilient goals and implementation measures to reach those goals. So that to me would be helpful in that process of the salt and nutrient management plan, but it would also provide us with important information that we can use to go forward and identify areas to focus. We can also get that too from these groundwater sustainability plans that will be forthcoming for the high and medium groundwater basins in our region. So steps to get there, like I said, what's our inventory? What are we expecting for projects that might come through the door where we have the opportunity to work and encourage LID? We heard, like I said, LID outreach. People wanted to really have that outreach component. Maybe a review of what are the outreach efforts that have been done, what's been successful, and what could we propose as a plan to go forward to do outreach to the communities. And we do have some ability to leverage existing efforts underway. San Bernardino County received a Prop 40 Urban and Stormwater Management Grant, where they are actually developing low-impact development guidelines and a manual for urban watersheds. So, you know, we should use that tool that's already being developed. And we also have the ability through the State Board's Training Academy to provide some of this outreach to local governments. Okay, now I'm going to switch gears and highlight how the State Board is making progress toward statewide objectives identified in the State Board's comprehensive response to climate change. The State Board can take action in three broad categories. Mitigation, and here this is, again, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And we acknowledge that the most dramatic decreases here are going to be in the transportation and industrial sectors, but there is a component in the water sector that has to do with the energy expended when you're pumping, when you're treating, when you're delivering the water. So that's where the State Board has had some focus. And also strategies to increase long-term carbon storage in the environment and restoration to ensure that we're maintaining these environmental carbon sinks. So the State Board's also adapting to climate change by building resilience to climate change impacts, and they're providing support to facilitate implementation of climate change response strategies. As far as mitigation, here we see where the State Board is working to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. And methane capture is one area. The composting general order, and also supporting CalRecycle efforts. We're reducing the green waste and the organic waste that is being diverted from landfills, where it could otherwise release methane as it decomposes. That's supporting CalRecycle's efforts, and it's also CDFA, it's supporting the Healthy Soils Initiative there. Also, State Board received a US EPA grant. They're doing a lot of research on co-digestion, the potential of the anaerobic digesters at wastewater treatment plants to receive this organic matter from the landfills. What benefit is that? And, you know, we're reducing the fugitive emissions that would be produced if these organic waste went to the landfill. But it's also the wastewater treatment plant benefits by reusing potentially the resulting byproducts, the biomethane, to offset their own energy use. There's a lot of things that need to be worked out, research with that. What are the economic benefits? What are the impacts from transporting that organic waste to the facility? So then as far as the other three areas you see here, water conservation, recycled water, and stormwater, what is being done here is basically reducing the fossil fuel-based energy used to pump, deliver, and treat because we're being more efficient. We're conserving water. Since the governor's emergency order in 2015, the state conserved 1.6 million acre feet, just as an equivalent. That was equivalent to removing 110,000 cars off the road. So with that, we're spending less energy getting the water to the household, that end user. Then recycle water, that it builds the local supply. So you're removing the delivery because you're relying more on that local supply. And then again with stormwater, there's less reliance on imported water because DWR and other agencies, they're prioritizing stormwater capture and infiltration for purposes of increasing this local supply. Adaptation and support, improving resiliency and responding to impacts. So here we're moving on to efforts that the State Board is making to adapt to climate change impacts. In the drinking water sector, Division of Drinking Water is taking a number of steps to enhance climate readiness for public water systems through annual reporting. They're starting that conversation and that dialogue. How are they preparing for climate change? Infrastructure vulnerability. Recently, not a lot of applicability in our region, but the rising sea level, the state of California put out the sea level rise guidance. That though not applicable in our region, we can use tools like ARC that was developed by USGS ArcStorm, where we can project these large storms. How can we then focus infrastructure maintenance, renewable repair? Protecting resources and storage. There's work being done here to develop underutilized water resources and expand storage. And then one way mechanism here is working on temporary water rights for underground storage and groundwater resource recharge. So basically here we're developing underutilized resources. High runoff events. In wet years, floodwaters can be diverted off of rivers and streams and infiltrated into the ground to help raise those groundwater levels and augment the water supplies for the dry years to come. Also, surface water augmentation for using recycled water. This is diversifying our supply. This was recently adopted March 2018. It establishes uniform criteria for planned placement of recycled water into surface water reservoirs that are sources for the raw drinking water supply. Protecting and restoring ecosystems so they better adapt and cope with changes. For inland waters, we're working on setting achievable flow standards for drought conditions, and also work in progress to minimize the increased nutrients that come with a lot of the climate impacts, these flashy floods, droughts. We're actually biostimulatory and biointegrity standards projects. And then the funding, outreach, information sharing, and access to data that is designed, one, to help people who are implementing the projects so they can do a better job, and also on our side, data collection and portals where we can use the data to make more informed, better decisions. Okay, so how are we fitting in and aligning with the state board's process? Well, in mitigation, we're doing that through the dairy and concentrated animal feeding operation general permit. We're working to incorporate some of the recommended approaches for composting manure, which would reduce the methane emissions. Also, we're promoting stormwater capture and reuse and trying to encourage LID. We already do this in Tahoe, in part with the 20-year, one-hour requirement to retain that on site. We can perhaps expand that to build local storage and reduce energy needs for imported water. One area where I do feel that we fall short on is the mitigation potential of reducing black carbon emissions related to catastrophic forest fires. The strategy has been, I guess maybe a lot of focus is on the federal lands permit for that, but I think the strategy needs to identify areas, policy language, that we will support these higher level strategies to improve the health and resilience of forests. And those higher level strategies are before you tonight. It's Governor Brown's order that just came out last week. And it's also the forest carbon plan that was just released, with which the order refers back to. There's these consensus forest practices that are encouraged to be implemented. We need to be reviewing these plans to see that they align with our mission of protecting water quality, reviewing the plans, inspecting these treatments, these vegetation and area treatments. Because when we see the forests improve, we're going to see the water quality improvements that come with that as well. And then there's also the benefit of maintaining that carbon sink. So the forest is a sink. It's not a source of black carbon when it goes up and swim. And there may be some ability to get that into the strategy that we're going to support those higher-level decisions, and then the federal lands permit can maybe embed some of that as it moves forward. Adaptation, increasing the pay scale and efficacy of the meadow restoration. We're seeing that at the state board level being supported. We also, that's one of our overarching goals that we want to move forward and support those efforts as well, because we know that there's that benefit to sequester carbon, but also multiple benefits you get from that high meadow restoration. And then adaptation, responding to climate change impacts, that would be, you know, getting those wastewater treatment facilities that are in at-risk areas out of those sensitive areas. Also, protecting the critical recharge areas. Okay, moving on, elements of the strategy that will, I promise, come before you someday, soon. Effects, we would include current and anticipated impacts to water quality and water resources. Goals, we went over them tonight. These are the overarching goals. And then that would also include leveraging efforts by others to achieve some of these goals. And the actions would involve and include actions that are within the water board's sphere of regulatory authority, utilizing our permitting tools, our policies, and then we'd also partner with efforts underway or planned to fill the gaps. Prioritization process. We want to identify, you know, we're going to present a suite of actions that could be considered to mitigate and adapt. You know, how do we prioritize which ones to maybe tackle first and spend some time on? Maybe threat to public health and water quality, the cost, political controversy, ease of change, does it have a short or long-term benefit, and staff resources to develop whatever that action is, and the magnitude of gain from the action when it was implemented. And then as far as schedule, I did mention we want to actually include some steps that we can start working on in the near future, that 1 to 3 year horizon, which we would already begin in this technical working group phase. Also, we may, you know, need to consider and redefine existing priorities as far as the schedule of moving forward with some of these actions we identified for our strategy. That may shift where our existing priorities are in our region. Things that, you know, we're working on that have been identified in work plans might get redefined a little. And that may, the process to do that might be in the triennial review process in this, to make sure that those projects are on there. And then wrapping up with key considerations. So, you know, we've realized along this journey that it has been a heavy lift. There's been a lot of different staff involved. It's been a moving schedule. There's been limited resources, and it's an evolving process, and there's constantly new information coming in, and I love it. It's really interesting, but it's really hard to keep on top of it. Just recently, last week, there were 4 major reports that were released that were important, and I was not able to give them the level of review I'd like. But I have someone who can help you with your questions, Amy. And then expanding existing localized concepts region-wide. Again, there's that Tahoe Truckee, tried and true. These things are working. They've been in place for years. The 20-year, one-hour requirement to infiltrate. There's your stormwater. We're keeping the source local, building that up. We can apply that other places. And also some of the land development prohibitions that are protected sensitive areas in Tahoe and Truckee. Expand them in our southern region. Engaging with stakeholders in the regulated community so actions align as much as possible. And we don't want interests to compete. Continue to engage with the public and provide transparency. We may have to shift annual priorities and work plans as we realize adaptation concepts. We're seeing this sort of with the swamp program now, where we are having to put a lot of attention on HABs, the harmful algal bloom, you know, responding to that. We're hoping that these workshops, though, will build partnerships with individuals who can respond when we can't get there quick enough. We also need to realize that climate change mitigation and adaptation may require some departure from traditional ways of thinking and conventional solutions. Examples here would be re-examining our anti-degradation requirements, maybe to allow more groundwater to recharge and to be stored. Gray water, we need to rethink maybe our prohibition so we allow more reuse and recharge. And, you know, with the forest fire, the executive order, and healthier forests, maybe, you know, creative ways to incentivize the use of woody products generated from these increased management of the forests. And, you know, we need to continue to work with the state board on adopting policies that will help us move forward, help our implementers move forward, and also funding to facilitate adaptation, too. So that is what I have, except for this slide's for Pete's sake. Because he said this, I think, at one of our outreach meeting, and it really resonated and held, and I think it's going to be key to how anyone moves forward with climate change. And, you know, it's an issue that we all face. So we have to work together.
Thank you. Questions or comments, and more comments? Mr. Dias?
Yes, thank you. Mary, I've got one question on slide number 11. Within the 2 to 6 months phase, you suggest that we conduct inventory of new development projects and leverage information in city and county general plans. I'm not sure I understand how we can leverage the information. Could you give me an example?
That was when I was talking about the Senate bill that requires the general plans to identify their vulnerability and then also identify their goals for adapting and then actually proposing implementation measures on how they're going to build resiliency. So using that. And then the projected inventory of what's coming down, what for development and new projects within a community or city.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Dr. Horn.
Thank you. Mary, congratulations on doing a good job on a very heavy lift. This is an overwhelming task to undertake. And you've pulled a lot of stuff together. If we could go two slides back to the ones that says increase protection of infrastructure and critical recharge areas. Other direction. There you go. Okay, so I want to relate a question that came to me from about recharge areas, and then expand the question to what we can do across our region. So the specific situation was the Truckee Gunner PUD came to me and said they were aware of a number of critical recharge areas in the Martis Valley that are on private land, and they have no ability to protect those recharge areas. And they are important not only for recharging the important groundwater basin in the Martis Valley, but also because those are areas that sequester a great deal of carbon, and the PUD is interested in protecting them from both areas, but they have neither the funding nor the authority to protect critical recharge areas on private land. And to some degree, that information is proprietary because it's on private land, but they do have some indication of where these critical recharge areas are. So, I'm interested in knowing how the Water Board can help a local agency identify and protect critical recharge areas on private land such as these, and how we can expand that across the Lahontan region. And if you don't have anything any ideas to offer about that tonight, just I'd like that to be put on a list of things that we look into, because this is, I think, a very important thing for our region and the climate change adaptation and mitigation. If you want to respond, I'll stop.
Well, because it's private, would that be missed when Martis Valley, which has been identified, I believe, as a medium priority groundwater basin?
It is, but as far as I know, nothing has happened with Martis Valley. So.
No, but it will by 2022, I think, is when it has to happen. Under SGMA, the groundwater sustainable agencies, and we can actually find out if someone stepped up. I'm looking at Jan. She knows everything. where's our groundwater person? By 2022, for all the high and medium groundwater basins, these plans have to be developed. But I don't know how you get at that private.
I don't know. Maybe, yeah. Whether
but
the integrated
that would be
water
something
management, the Irwins maybe can get at this. I don't know.
Rob, yeah.
I was just curious. Can Tees Tahoe City Public Utility become their own SGMA if they're the primary?
This is not Tahoe City. This is Tahoe. Donner, so this is
oh,
not.
Oh, sorry.
But
the same applies as whether they can become the lead for the SGMA for that area.
South Tahoe PUD is the lead for.
Yes, because they're one of the largest water purveyors, and the county doesn't step up, can't. The utility district that is using the water in the majority become the lead for the SGMA.
That's a good question. I will go ask them, and we'll get back to you. I made a note, a job for myself. Okay. All right. So going to the next slide, increased protection and restoration of wetlands and floodplains and headwaters. So I mentioned before the meeting and talking to you that, you were in the right place. Go to the slide that says... the other slide where the blue square says meadow restoration, not infrastructure. There you go. Okay. So meadow restoration is really important for a lot of reasons, and they do sequester carbon at a high rate when they are healthy meadows, but they are a very small percentage of our landscape. And so this whole section needs to be expanded to protection and restoration of wetlands, floodplains, and headwaters, forests, or basically forests.
Right.
I can talk a little bit more about that after one more point to make, which is on slide 13, which is the one, it's a blue slide that has mitigation at the top in big letters. It's about four slides forward from here. Keep going. Next one. There you go. Okay. So the subheading on this only describes half of the equation. So mitigation is half of it is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The other half of it is increasing greenhouse gas sequestration.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
The original and natural way to sequester greenhouse gases was through photosynthesis. So we've got all these plants out there. How do we make them work for us? So that's a comment about that, which in thinking about this, it's really time. So you mentioned that Governor Brown issued another executive order And thank you to providing us all with the Improving California's Forest and Watershed Management Report, which is a recent report by the Legislative Analyst's Office. I recently heard the Deputy Director of the Resources Agency say in his 30 years of working in California government, he has never seen three important papers be issued on a single subject within a single year, as has happened with forest management this past year. First PPIC Headwaters Forest Report, then the Little Hoover Commission report about forest management, and now the LAO report, and they each one gets better and better.
This just came out. This is the California Forest Carbon Plan, which is referred to in the executive order.
Yeah, and I haven't read that yet.
Yeah.
But, okay, so there, I've been spending a lot of time sitting in meetings, tracking all of this. Things are changing very rapidly. The amount of money in the current that's proposed in the current budget to go to work in the forests is enormous. It's several orders of magnitude. Maybe Dee knows off the top of her head. The governor is proposing significant increase in money to go to forest management in the state. It's really straining existing agencies. So the LAO report suggests taking money, moving authority for forest management at the state level out of CAL FIRE to the Department of Resources itself. So that's kind of an eye-opener right there. The Forest Service is talking about doing planning on a super forest, creating super forests for their planning regions. So it's, it's... Everybody's aware that we have to increase significantly the pace of scale of forest management in this state, and there's a total disconnect between the pace and scale of both CEQA and NEPA planning and the pace and scale at which things need to happen. Mm-hmm. A lot of NGOs and local agencies are staring at the amount of money that's potentially coming down the pike and really being afraid of failing just because they lack the capacity to deal with the amount of work that they're being asked to do now. So I think it's time, the time is appropriate for the Lahont Board to create a forest policy, a forest management policy. And I'll try to be brief. This is complicated. But the gist of the story is that the forests have changed so significantly since 1850 as a result of fire suppression, logging, and grazing that if Kit Carson was set down in the Sierra today, he would not know where he was. He would not recognize this place. There are four times as many trees on the landscape. That the fuel loads are twice as high. That's important because that is what's generating the enormous wildfires that are devastating the landscape and creating ecosystem change so that where these forest fires happen, it doesn't come back as forest. It comes back as shrub and chaparral, and that changes a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of the forest is it's very homogeneous. It's, the trees are the same height, the same age, they're evenly spaced, and they're too dense. And whereas the forest that Kit Carson saw was very variable, there were pockets, there are dense pockets, there were gaps. Tree canopy covers 30% more land now than it did when Kit Carson was here. So that what that means in terms of water is that it, up in the snowpack area, more snow is intercepted by the tree crowns, and then it sublimates straight back into the atmosphere. It doesn't get down to the ground, so therefore it doesn't become part of the snowpack. It doesn't slowly melt and infiltrate the soil. It doesn't recharge the groundwater, and it doesn't provide for late summer stream flow. So that's changing the whole hydrology of the forest. The water quality impacts of fire, increased sediment, debris, chemicals from firefighting, we all know about that. My concern is that with all of the money and pressure to do work in the forest, I don't see a coherent policy about what kind of work needs to be done in the forest and what the forest should look like to restore the ecosystem structure and function that Kit Carson saw when he came here. And that is what's going to make our forest resilient to climate change and to also improve their ability to mitigate climate change, to sequester carbon. I think it would be useful for the Lahontan Board to develop a policy, a forest management policy, that steers the direction in which the forest management should go. That is all.
Can I respond now, or should I wait?
Certainly.
On the last comment, I think some of that actually may be contained in here,
okay,
in the California Forest Carbon Plan, which the governor's executive order refers to, that projects should implement consensus practices that are defined in here. I don't know if they get to the level of prescription where, what did we talk about the other day, the structures.
Forest stand structure.
Yeah, forest stand structure and density and sizes of trees, you know, eliminating that homogeneity. I don't know if that is in here, but it may be,
okay,
which would help with our forest policy if we go that route. And then back to the first comment, I don't disagree. I know that forests, in comparison, dwarf the meadows, but I do think that though they're small compared to the forest, they are still highly valued in their ability.
No disagreement.
You know, because of the connection to the California water supply, but also, you know, they're vital to the watersheds. I think we do, like you said, it's part of the forest landscape, that meadow. So whether we look at it holistically with that forest management project or the meadow restoration projects individually, that's something, you know, we're going to need to consider going forward, because we're going to see a lot of meadow restoration projects come before us with the Prop 1 that was just released. And more will be released in October. I believe those funds are for implementation, which, you know, I would recommend maybe an entity like Sierra Meadow Partnership. Maybe they work with consult to do a programmatic EIR.
Yeah, that might be what happens. I mean, a landscape ecologist would not distinguish between meadows and forests. They would look at the landscape,
mm-hmm,
and incorporate both areas into it. But the other thing I understand is that Sierra Meadows Partnership is being handed over to Point Blue Conservation.
Mark Drew has left.
Yeah.
Caltrout, and yeah, he's in Cambodia with WWF.
Right. So I mean, it's just
he spearheaded the partnership.
It's still going on. It's just not Mark Drew
right.
who's running it anymore. Yeah. But yeah. So my comment is that we should add forests into this. I'm not taking away from the meadow. I'm just saying add forests into this. After all, I've been pushing meadow restoration
yeah.
for a while.
Okay. This is probably you have to leave right now, but Mr. Sandell, could you have an announcement?
And after the discussion's been exhausted, I have no comments.
It's really hard to hear.
Ms. Collins.
Thank you, Vice Chair. You know, Mary, when you look at your second slide, kudos. That is a huge, huge amount of work. And we've come a very, very long way in just four short years. I mean, you are to be congratulated and commended for this effort. I mean, each box represents hundreds of hours of work.
and effort. I think in this process we have to continue to remain nimble and to synthesize with what the state board is doing and wherever possible to capitalize on those efforts to be adapted in our region. But that's just, to me, that slide says it all, just a huge amount of work there. One of your concluding comments that you made about perhaps expanding the groundwater recharge, I think that is absolutely key. And that when we look at my very arid region down south, where we only get 5 inches of rainfall at that a year, that recharge is critical to our groundwater basin. So when we look at the concepts being developed on low impact development, I think we have to be flexible when we include those requirements and be cognizant of the region within which that development is occurring. So look at a variety of BMPs, one for, you know, a more arid environment and one for maybe a more sensitive area that gets greater rainfall. But I'm just hugely impressed with the amount of work that has been accomplished in just 4 short years. Thank you.
Yes, I have to agree with Ms. Cox on that matter. A great deal of work has been accomplished, and we're right on the right path. I have a quick question of you. When you do these workshops, I've visited with the Washoe Tribe regarding some projects they plan in the Lake Tahoe Basin. Are they participants in the workshops?
They certainly could be, especially in the goal that you see those projects fitting into. Absolutely.
Fits right in with what Dr. Horn was just talking about, changing forest management, restoring it to pre-European settlement days, especially in the Meeks Bay area. Also, as we talk about the Forest Service and the order that came down from the governor, that clearly affects Region 5 of the U.S. Forest Service. A great portion of Alpine County and the east side of the Sierras is in Region 4, out of Ogden, Utah. They have a different relationship with the state of California, where Alpine County and other counties, RCRC, Regional Council, Rural Counties, are trying to remedy that. But are they participating in your meetings, workshops?
No.
That would be Humboldt-Toyabe. Yeah. Humboldt-Toyabe National Forest.
And Monday of this week, I was talking with, on another matter, the Carson River drainage that starts, the headwaters are in Alpine County. The U.S. Geological Survey was going to do a presentation modeling of the Carson River. They were unaware of this meeting and this presentation, but I'll put them in touch with you. It's my most recent discussions with them, it sounded like they were going to send a representative down here. But it was just short notice.
You know, in the technical working groups, I don't want to disillusion you. They are not going to capture everything. What was presented was just, you know, something that within the suite of many actions that could be taken, the internal working group staff saw these as actions that we could maybe move forward with in the short term, 1 to 3 year horizon. But, you know, we can have discussions, maybe that should shift and be more towards the forest now, especially with the levity of all the stuff that was just released.
Yes.
You know, we're seeing an order to focus efforts there.
I look forward to getting copies and relaying them on to powers that be. Are there any further comments? that. Thank you so much. That was quite an education. Just listening. Move on to item six. Reports by Water Board Chair and Board Members. And
I have no report, thank you.
Who has been patiently waiting all evening?
Good evening. Good to see you all. I've got a few things to go over, but just in response to some of the points that were made in this last presentation, I did look it up. I don't have a total dollar figure on the increase for forest management. But there's a forest carbon plan that in total between the May revise and what was originally proposed in January is $265 million. But then there's additional funding for a variety of different efforts. So I wasn't able to go through it and cobble it together, but a significant increase. Okay, and then the other thing that I thought that I would mention is on groundwater recharge. So our Division of Water Rights is working with our undersecretary on seeing what we can do to facilitate groundwater recharge projects. There's, without getting into a lot of detail, oftentimes there are some challenges because recharge is not a beneficial use, but we are looking into ways to provide some increased flexibility, especially where it's for the entire basin, which is what a lot of the groundwater sustainability plans are going to be looking at. And although it's not mandated, all groundwater sustainability agencies are looking at increased opportunities for recharge, because otherwise it's just a zero-sum game, what goes out, what comes in. It will definitely impact use. So to my knowledge, you know, the GSPs have already been established, and for overdrafted basins, they're working on the development of the plans as we speak. I wanted to just go through, I've left my notes, wanted to go through a couple of,
just one quick response on the groundwater recharge is my understanding is that groundwater recharge can happen up in the Sierra, so it's not necessarily part of any particular groundwater basin that's doing a sustainability plan or a GSA, a groundwater sustainability.
In terms of forest management and some of the issues we were talking about.
Right,
earlier.
Correct.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so that this forest management that happens up on public land can help groundwater basins that are pretty far away from them.
We're talking about the forest management improvements would result in a recharge on macro level.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. The sustainability agencies are looking at specific projects.
Right.
And capturing high flows, but capturing high flows oftentimes may already be spoken for.
That's
downstream, and
that's
so having to go through a water availability analysis, and so there's a lot of good ideas, and I can talk with you offline if you want to have, you know, more information, because I know the hour is late here. So first of all, I do want to thank Region 6 Ms. Kamujian for appearing before our board. We also received a climate change informational item last month. And so our staff provided us with an update, and because Region 3 really has, or Region 6 has stepped up on this, you know, quite some time ago, all of the regional boards are in the process, either having already put together a resolution or in the process of adopting one, but I believe 6 may have been the first. And so it was great to hear a very similar presentation for our whole board. This week, some significant issues going on over the legislature. The water conservation bills are on the floor, and I believe one was adopted today. There are two bills that double joined Skinner and Friedman, and we are looking at additional authorities for the water boards. So the bill outlines a schedule for gallons per capita per day for indoor use, starting at 55 as a target, and then ratcheting down over a period of years until 2030, down to 50 gallons per capita per day. And then we will receive authority to adopt regulations for outdoor efficiency, and that will be the product of studies and development of guidelines between our staff and the Department of Water Resources. But once those recommendations come out, we would actually be would have the authority to adopt regulations and implement those regulations. So new authorities likely coming our way. The other bill is likely to be voted on this week sometime, and those bills would go to the governor for his signature. Recycled water, we have, our staff has released a direct potable reuse framework, and that framework puts out information on moving forward for the development of direct potable reuse, outlining how to consider and evaluate public health risks, risk management, and also various permitting options. And so this is definitely an opportunity for all that are interested to get involved. We've got staff is doing a number of workshops, and it'll be coming before our board by the end of this year. We're also updating our recycled water policy. This is an area that I think you mentioned earlier, Patty, about greater connectivity between IRWMs and salt and nutrient management plans, and the ability to interface more with those. It'll also be providing for, it'll place a requirement for the reporting of recycled water use. There's a lot of thought out there that we can go further with. Right now we have about 700,000 acre feet per year in recycled water use. Just over the last several years, an increase of 200,000, but really need to get to the place where we can have a better sense of how much further we can push this. We do have a survey that comes out every 5 years, and we are short of our targeted goal of 1 million acre feet, but our staff thinks, and I agree with them, that we have to get a better handle on just how much further we can push this. In some areas, it might be best not to have recycled water because that wastewater discharge can provide beneficial uses in rivers and streams. And in other areas, it makes quite a lot of sense. So just trying to get a better handle on what is available potentially for recycled water. The governor, I know that I have spoke a couple of times regarding SB 623, the drinking water proposal that is before the legislature. The governor has rolled out as part of the revise the budget trailer bill, which contains essentially the guts of SB 623. And so this is absolutely an administration, very top priority, and we're keeping our fingers crossed at the water board, that will actually get through, because we see that the real challenge is the lack of technical, managerial, and financial capacity. Our SRF funds can only go so far, and our consolidation efforts in providing safe drinking water for communities. Another interesting development that was included in the budget trailer bill is a new program that we would have administrative law judges through our hearing unit. Right now, we as individual board members act in an adjudicatory capacity when we receive petitions before us and act on orders. Right now, three of us are working on the Cal Water fix. It's taken up a lot of time, and we are not experts as hearing officers. And so there was a bill introduced last year that the governor vetoed that would have required us to have a formal hearing officers unit that would be staffed by attorneys. And the governor, in his signing message, did indicate that it looked like there might be some merit to the proposal, and that he was directing Secretary Rodriguez to issue a report on other options and ways to approach some of the requirements that were in the Gray bill that the governor vetoed. And our Undersecretary Gordon Burns have been working on this for most of the year, and determined that, yes, this is probably something that could be quite useful, especially also with the enforcement that will be coming our way with cannabis. And so that will be a new program that we will start up with next year if it ends up getting approved. Looking at the remainder of this administration and some of the top priorities that we have, I think I've talked before about just the processing of the Cal Water Fix petition that's before us, bringing the water quality control plan before us. We've got two phases, San Joaquin Phase 1, Sacramento Phase 2. If you look at a map of the impacted areas of Phase 2, it's pretty much the whole state of California, because we're talking about the Sacramento River, the tributaries, and, of course, the communities that receive water from those areas. So this is a huge undertaking, but we are committed to wrapping things up by the end of this term. And so we'll be quite busy on mainly those two projects. But we are still moving forward on some of the water quality issues that I've reported on in the past, bacteria standards, toxicity amendments, sediment quality objectives, Chrome 6. We've got our wetlands procedures, also known as dredge and fill, that does have incentivized provisions for meadow restoration and wetland restoration. So I think that you'll be happy to see that when the draft comes out, but staff is still working on the finishing touches there. And then our winery general order. And another priority, of course, is cannabis implementation and enforcement. I would like to direct you to our executive director puts out a report once a month, and I think the report has improved since Eileen Sobeck has taken over. It's a little shorter, easier to read, and we have a consolidated cannabis section so that it goes through the various functions through the Division of Water Rights and enforcement that we have for cannabis, and we go through each region. We also have a consolidated report on irrigated lands and what each region is doing, and I have found both of those to be quite useful, just to get a quick snapshot on, you know, what the various regions are doing. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions from board members?
No. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
See you all. Thank you.
With that, I'll push on then to item 7, Executive Officer's Report.
Well, good evening. I put you here. Good evening, Vice Chair Jardine and board members. I'm going to provide you some updates to my May written report, which is in your packet. But I'd like to start by thanking the Eastern Sierra Land Trust for graciously hosting our tour tomorrow. If you don't have maps and directions, you get extras here. Mm-hmm. And just a reminder, we're meeting at 8:30 across the parking lot, right across the way, to head out. Our next board meeting is July 18th and 19th, is the exact same location, so we'll see each other soon again in July. Let me start with the personnel report, and I guess I have to start with probably the elephant in the room. Our dear Kathy Utterman is leaving us. This is her last board meeting. She is going to the Housing and Community Development Agency as a Minister of Assistant there.
She's been a wonderful board clerk, executive assistant, and sadly miss her. I wish her much happiness because I know it's a promotion and a great opportunity for her. But I can't thank you enough, Kathy, for everything you've done for our agency, our staff, and our board. We truly are going to miss you.
Same here.
Yes.
Hard to follow that one, but just FYI, as Dee talked about cannabis, we've been given the green light to hire 3 more positions. And the cannabis unit is July, and we transferred 1 person internally from 1 unit to the cannabis unit. So we also are in this room for the next 2 days for our managers and supervisors to get together quarterly to meet on work plans and many other issues. So we'll all be here hunkering down in Bishop a little bit longer. Let me move to harmful algal blooms. There's a nice write-up in your EO report on Batestamp 7-10. And I'd like to update you on the workshop. You heard Mary mention them a little bit earlier. The one in Bishop is set for June 27th. As you heard her say, we've got awful lot of interest, which is a wonderful thing to hear. But lots of people are interested in participating. We plan to have a second workshop in the Victorville area, and we're reaching out to stakeholders on possible times, but somewhere between August 6th and 9th, we'll be having one down south. So I'm going to now switch to the Edwards Air Force Base dispute, which is on Batestamp 7-12. An update to that is after Doug Smith went into Washington, we were asked, DOD and TOCS were asked to do risk assessment calculations. Those have been turned in now to US EPA. So I guess where we are on that is we wait. Administrator Scott Pruitt has all the information from everyone, and the decision now lies in his hands, and so we're going to wait to hear what happens. So we all have wishful thinking here from California that they will side with us. I'm going to go to salt nutrient management plans on the heels of the one that we just heard about earlier today. That's in Batestamp 7-13, and there's a nice matrix a little later in the EO report, which gives you kind of update on all of them that are in the queue. One thing that has changed that's new is Lisa Dernbach is now our lead on salt nutrient management plans. We finally have, a dedicated staff person to really devote some time on those. You heard the Fremont today. Honey Lake is in the works that might be coming to you down the lane. Tahoe Sierra as well, the Tehachapi. The ones that are still struggling are Martins Valley and Inyumon. So we're going to work with them, and that's what Lisa's on board to help us with. And you heard me mention the draft recycled water policy. The state, if adopted by the state board, will have a bit more tasks and efforts for us to work on salt nutrient management plans. And I think that's good because I think we have over 300-ish groundwater basins in our region. I think we did the first round of salt nutrient management plans prioritizing. These were, I would call them, must-haves. But I think there's some effort to look at the should-haves and nice-to-haves because I think as funding is being tailored, you're going to see more like Fremont, who maybe are a low-priority basin, want to get a salt nutrient management plan. So I eventually see an increased flow of the salt nutrient management plans to our regional board. Let me shift now to the Carson River spill. This was a spill that happened last week where a truck overturned. Sadly, there was a fatality, and it was near the Woodford's Caltrans station on Highway 88. For a time, the highway was shut down when they were dealing with it. This was a solution of hypochlorite, which is high-strength chlorine, and it was quite a spill, about shy of 5,000 gallons, roughly. The good news is that we didn't really detect a whole lot in the river, and Nevada helped us as well, so it was really a collaborative effort between California and Nevada to look at it. So that's the good news. We're not seeing any big numbers in the river. We didn't see any fish kills. That's another good news. We saw deaths on mackerel, Beth and vertebrates, and we'll be doing some more work with Fish and Wildlife to assay that and see the damage. Next Monday, you're going to see, we're going to see some active work on the site. We're going to be removing the soils up to 3 inches in about the 5,000 square foot area where that was damaged. And eventually, when that's cleaned up, they're going to hydroseed and re-veg the area. So that's kind of where that spill is. Let me just give you a quick update in Leviathan. I don't know if you recall, last time I was here, we were hoping for emergency contract, which we got. The folks are out there, they've done the first round of treatments, and now they have the ponds, I guess I would call in a standby, or in my opinion, a safer level, because we've kind of treated what we thought was the problematic level. So now, you know, we're just, I think, in good shape, because we've got a contractor up there, and I think we'll be ready for the next rounds of storms in Leviathan. So that's, you know, for those of us in the Leviathan, they can sleep easy a little bit better now, instead of biting their nails, wondering if the pond was going to overspill. Let me just update you on the chairs meeting. There was a chairs meeting where all the chairs of the regional boards and the state board board members and which should go to on April 23rd in Sacramento. We received some good updates from the governor's office and Calicia Secretary Nick Rodriguez. There were three interesting discussions, some of them which may come to WQCC later in the fall. One was on the auto dismantler presentation of illegal facilities. There are up to 30% of all the auto dismantlers are illegal. It's a little bit corollary to cannabis. These are really highly hazardous waste problem sites. Often they have other illegal activities at them as well, with drugs and firearms and many other things. So they're really kind of problem sites. DMV is heading up a strike force, of which the regional boards participate on. DMV has licensed law enforcement officers, and as I've described the dangerous nature of these, it's important to go in. But like cannabis, they love it when the regional boards go along with them, because the regional boards have the enforcement tools and penalty tools that DMV does not, nor the other agencies. So it's really a group effort to go in, and they kind of highlight areas and then do a whole strike on a number of these. Again, very similar to how cannabis is being, illegal cannabis was being targeted. So we'll be seeing more of that in our region. And there was a discussion, as I mentioned, about the increasing nexus between SGMA reports and plans and salt nutrient management plans, and how those really support each other going forward. So I think it's the beginning of an interesting policy dialogue. And you see some of that in the recycled water policy draft. At some point, this is just my opinion, at some point down the road, as SGMA gets more involved, we may have to look at other chemicals other than just salt and nutrients if we're going to look at water quality. So over time, I think there'll be more robust information about a number of constituents that we could care about for water quality. I'm going to now shift to LADWP since Ron Bishop seems apropos. We have regular meetings with LADWP as staff to try to collaborate with them to improve areas. And so we had a good meeting recently with them. We again encouraged them to participate in the Inyomono Irwin, and we really would like them to help us move forward with salt nutrient management plan. So we're going to see if they're going to help us with that. We talked about the regulatory efforts on grazing and our beginning steps of collaborating with them on a regulatory approach on cattle grazing on LADWP lands. We talked about the water curtailment in Mono County, which is quite a political hot potato these days in Long Valley, where they're cutting off the water. So we talked a little bit about that. We talked about Bishop Creek sampling and the potential 303D listing process. We talked about copper sulfate and their need to get data in. They're still lacking on giving us the information we've requested to process their application. And a new issue, Owens Lake gopher control. I guess they have a big gopher problem on Owens Lake, and they would like to fumigate a big part of the lake bottom. Yeah, we're working on that. So I'm not so sure if fumigating the entire lake bottom is maybe the best choice. But we're working with them on that. And, of course, the general order for maintenance and the CEQA document. So staff will be sitting, particularly Jan, will be sitting shortly with LADWP to kind of slog through the CEQA document and our comments. The Barstow drinking water request, I think I sent that around, you know, as a reminder. Those are the 17 residents down the Barstow area that need replacement water for the Coric plume. We're asking for $42,000 for 2 years' worth of funding. We have, for the last 7 years, given these people drinking water. It's a small little group of folks, and they desperately need the money, and I'm not sure that they can afford the money if it goes away. We have an emergency request in. Problem is, the latest survey has now, because some people of a higher income have moved into the area, they no longer qualify as a disadvantaged community. So we're attempting to see what we could do with a survey to try to figure this out, but there is a possibility the state would no longer fund those 17 residents. I'm hopeful we can do that, but there's no guarantees. I just wanted to let you know that. But we're certainly doing everything within our power to see what we could do to help those folks.
Seems like there should be a grandfather clause for situations like this.
I would hope, because these people have been depending on this water.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's, they can't afford the couple hundred bucks a month to pay for it themselves. I know that for a fact. At least 17 folks. I want to talk a little bit, since we're in on disadvantaged communities, about tribal consultations. As a result of new legislation, we have a more structured process of reaching out to the tribes to get them participating in our regulatory decisions in the CEQA process. And so we're starting to do more formal sit-downs with them. And so one of ours, I think it was this week, we met the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians regarding our Mojave River Basin Plan Amendment. So it's actually kind of a nice effort. I think our staff are enjoying being able to sit down and really work with the tribes on some key issues, and we'll be doing more and more of that in our region. I was going to mention the executive order, which is in your packet. This is the governor's executive order on forestry, and so you've probably heard a lot of talk already this evening about that and how it's going to be doubling our forestry, healthy forest acreage, and obviously a lot more money towards the effort, and that's in addition to the past bond and pastures budget also had money in for forest. So I think we're on a good trend or trajectory with more work and more efforts, lots of reports out there, extra money. I hope it continues on a trajectory because there's so much more work to do and so much more money needed.
Just one qualification. So the executive order calls for treating 500,000 acres per year. That's lands that are under the purview of the state of California.
Yes.
That, and at the same time, the Forest Service and BLM are talking about increasing their management of lands to 500,000 acres per year. So currently, the Forest Service is managing about 50,000 acres per year, and I don't know what Cal Fire has been managing, but I mean we're talking a couple of zeros in terms of numbers of acres per year that we're trying to ramp up to, which is tough.
Yes, tough.
Very good.
Anyways, those are all the my reports. But are there any questions?
I just wanted to mention on the Woodbridge accident, the hazmat spill, I personally had to thank the Nevada National Guard hazmat response team, all the various agencies, because me on the east side on the border of Nevada, we work collaboratively together with them, so, and with South Central, and more with Nevada. But, thank goodness no one else was hurt.
Yeah, it was quite the team effort. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, nothing else? We will adjourn and meet tomorrow at 8:30?
Yep, 8:30.
I'm sorry?
All
yep, we'll be grabbing it all, packing it tonight. You can rest assured.
And I
just
want
to let you know
that
we're trying
to
make
sure that all the rooms that are
warm. All right, the fun training yet to come. Oh, yeah, Amy did it in your inbox.
I think it's a little bit difficult for the board members. It should be a shorter training.
Quality of life.
Hopefully, one day.
I'll get you extra hours back in my office.
Yes.
But I will miss the people.
Yes, yes.
I'll be at the tour. Yeah. I'll have a backpack. I'll put them in there.
I'll be at the tour.